NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Good Thursday to you. Thank you for tuning in to another edition of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, right here on NRA TV. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, coming to you once again from beautiful downtown Farmville, Virginia today. Here in a couple of minutes, we will share with you a little peek at my trip down to Bristol, Tennessee, in the Bristol Motor Speedway, where I am pleased to report that the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race merchandise is already available there in the gift shop. So I came back with this lovely T-shirt promoting the night race, August. You can't see the date, but look at that. It's August 18th, 2018, and you can get your tickets. Why, my goodness gracious, we are less than a month away now from the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race. You can get your tickets at NRARaceTix.com. That is going to be the lowest price that you will be able to find for the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race anywhere, and we are looking forward to seeing you in Bristol, Tennessee, and maybe Bristol, Virginia as well, because it's right there on the border. Coming up here in about a month or so from now, Rob O'Donnell from Brothers Before Others. Join us later on the program this hour. Chad Dukes from 106.7 The Fan on the University of North Carolina's head football coach, talking about, you know, listen, if football goes away, you can kiss America goodbye too. All right. Plus, next hour, Jim Wallace of the Gun Owners Action League. You've got protests in Massachusetts regarding the light on crime policies and sentences that we've seen handed down by courts around the state. Also, Stella Morbido of the Federalist, what to learn about the social justice warrior who was eaten by his own mob. In hour three, Nora Swiden joins us from Warrior One in San Bernardino, California. We'll talk about the day that Sacha Baron Cohen walked into Norris's store in disguise, and Norris spotted him, called him out. We'll talk about that whole experience. Also, Kurt Schlichter from Town Hall. And want to welcome to the program right now our friend from National Review, Mr. Jim Garrity, is with us on the program. Jim, how are you, sir?
Cam, how are you doing?
I am good. I appreciate you coming on the program. I want to talk about something that, and I know you've written about this a little bit. Jazz Shot, Hot Air has written about this. There's probably been actually more national attention, certainly in the conservative media, than there has been local media attention to New York's 21st congressional district, a seat currently held by Elise Stefanik, who was elected back in 2014. She is a Republican, was the youngest member of Congress when she was elected, and she is squaring off against Tedra Cobb, the Democrat there, who was caught on tape, Jim, telling a group of young supporters about a conversation she had had earlier that day where she was at a luncheon and a woman said, I really want to ban these assault rifles. What do you think? Oh, I want to ban them too. Tedra Cobb says, but I can't say that. And the woman said, well, I wish that you would. And Tedra Cobb says, well, I can't because I won't win the election. And the Moms Demand Action volunteer even told me, hey, if you say that you support an assault weapons ban, you won't win the election. So I got to keep quiet about this. I've been fascinated, Jim, not only about how this has unfolded, but there have been some local papers, particularly the Post Star newspaper in upstate New York, which has like really gone out of their way to not see this as a story. As a matter of fact, when this came out, the paper had offered up this no lies pledge to both candidates, and they were trying to ding Elise Stefanik because she hadn't signed this pledge, and Tedra Cobb did. As it turns out, Tedra Cobb wasn't being honest. Who does the paper go after the day after the story breaks? They go after Elise Stefanik for not signing this pledge, as opposed to going after Tedra Cobb for, you know, not being honest with the voters. I'm fascinated by this particular congressional race, Jim, because this is one of those districts that Democrats are hoping to switch. It voted for Obama in 2008, 2012, went for Trump in 2016. And if the Democrats are going to take back the House, they're going to have to do it in districts like New York 21.
You know, Cam, this has been a big week for members of Congress or aspiring members of Congress, of finding themselves in a tough situation between what they want to do and where public opinion is. And I was thinking about earlier this week when they had that vote on support of ICE, and the big chunk of the Democratic House caucus decided to vote present, an old habit mm-hmm. that we recall back, President Obama back in the Illinois state legislature. You know, this Democrat challenger here has a familiar situation. You want to do something, but the votes aren't there in Congress, or public opinion isn't there with you. And I don't think there's anything inherently outrageous or something. You can say, you know, there's certain things I'd like to do, but I just don't think the votes are there. I don't think there's enough of a consensus, so I'm not going to push for that. And all people can agree with it, they can disagree with it. I think that's a perfectly valid answer. What I think is not a valid answer is to say, okay, I'm just going to tell you guys, I support this idea, but don't tell anyone, all right? I keep my real agenda secret from the voters. They can't know what I really stand for. They have to be, you know, nice. I support puppies and flowers and hearts and unicorns and all that kind of stuff. But trust me, once I'm in office, I'm going to totally push for this agenda that I hid from the electorate the whole time. That's the worst case scenario. That I think, you know, I think you can either rise or fall on your true beliefs and your principles and what you stand for. Or you can, you know, say, you know what, I'm only going to vote for things where I feel like there's enough of a broad political, social consensus for. This candidate did neither. Now, the idea that the local media would be tougher on a Republican candidate and than a Republican incumbent than a Democratic candidate, that's shocking. The coverage of the paper suggests that when you're confronted with that no lies pledge, the right move is to sign it and then ignore it rather than take the grief of not signing it because the paper's not going to call you out for it, apparently.
Yeah, it's amazing. And so the latest in this, so Tedra Cobb, campaign manager, resigned this week, just stepped down. Don't know exactly why.
Really, but good. People are hiring. They just had another opportunity out there. You know, the Trump economy, unemployment's low. You never know. It's hard to keep good talent these days.
Right. So there's a new campaign manager in now. And so this is another attempt to try to deal with this and the fallout from this. And so the Adirondack Daily Enterprise, which has been covering this story, says that Tedra Cobb has, quote, clarified her position on supporting a, quote unquote, assault weapons ban. Now, Jim, I want to read this statement to you, and you tell me if this provides more clarity than those comments that were recorded, that Tedra Cobb was unaware that she was being recorded, or if this is actually less clear. Quote, I should set this up. Her former campaign manager, Mike Sustak, said last Friday that Cobb could not speculate on how she would vote on hypothetical legislation. Which is pretty, I mean, that's a pretty amazing statement for a candidate to make. I can't speculate on how I might vote on any particular piece of legislation, but elect me to Congress. I mean, that's not
hypothetical. This isn't about, well, if the Loch Ness Monster swims ashore, how will we treat, you know, this is, if Feinstein has her legislation, this gets debated all the time. So the idea is, I support gun control, but I can't tell you how I would vote on any particular piece of legislation. No, that's not an improvement. That's not better. You know,
well, it should be noted again, the guy who made this statement is no longer the campaign manager. So he's out now, and so the Times,
Daily Enterprise,
exactly. So they asked how Cobb would vote on a ban like the one that was passed in 1994, and on Wednesday, yesterday, Cobb's campaign shared a statement from her about it. Quote, the 1994 assault weapons ban was well-meaning but very flawed. It created a new class of weapons and products for the market and did nothing to prevent the circumstances that led to murders at Sandy Hook, Virginia Tech, Parkland, Fort Hood, Santa Fe, and too many others to mention. There is a safe and sane way forward for people with goodwill and common sense. And that's the end of the statement.
Did some of it get cut off, Cam? Is there a second page with a lot more further explanation as to what those flaws in the assault weapons ban were and how she...
Or the safe and sane way forward? Yeah, no. Nope.
Okay.
Nope.
Look, this is a classic case of wanting to have it. The subtext of that statement is, look, if you support gun control, I agree with you and I want your vote. If you oppose gun control, I agree with you and I want your vote. And just pick, you know, roll the dice on me and hopefully you'll be, you know, one of you will turn out to be the winner. That's not a very particularly good idea. And, you know, here's the, like, look, I get it. You know, legislation is complicated. Laws are complicated. Every time they have to enact, as we discussed in this program many times, assault weapon. What do you mean by assault weapon? And generally, when you hear people just say, guns that look scary is what it usually boils down to, right? If it's got wood on it, they've decided it's not an assault weapon. But if it's all black, then it's very aesthetic based, which is, probably not the way you'd actually want to to classify guns. It's not really based on, you know, the appearance of the gun. Doesn't really change the velocity, doesn't change any of this kind of stuff. And by the way, she lists that, you know, well, despite the assault weapons ban, it didn't do anything to stop these mass shootings. Well, that kind of suggests it's not that good idea. I mean, like, you'd kind of figure you'd actually see a dramatic improvements when the idea you preferred is in effect. I realize you keep hearing this argument of, oh, we need ordinary citizens to jump into politics. We need the average person. You know, there are a whole bunch of, you know, Democrats challengers this year. They're like, oh, they don't haven't spent years in the state legislature. They haven't spent a long time in politics. And then they get there and they put with questions like this. And it turns out laws are complicated. And go figure. It helps if you know a little bit about them before one day you were watching the news and you got angry and you decided to run for Congress. So not surprising, and probably a particularly vivid example of how certain folks are going to say, look, vote for me, trust me, details on the actual laws I support to come.
Yeah. Well, you know, and there's one other takeaway, too, here. I mentioned that this is it's a Selena Zito-esque Great Revolt district, right? It went for Obama twice, went for Trump. Elise Stefanik, the Republican, elected in 2014. And again, these are the types of districts that Democrats are going to have to win if they want to take back the House. Saw a story last week about how this is the year that Democrats are not afraid to run on gun control, Jim. And it strikes me that, you know, this is also the year we saw Connor Lamb win a special election in Pennsylvania, not calling for gun control, but actually running ads where he's shooting an AR. Right. Mm-hmm. And here is another purple district where, you know, look, certainly Tedra Cobb is on the record as being very supportive of Moms Demand Action. Moms Demand Action has endorsed her. She's talked about, you know, some quote unquote common sense pieces of gun safety legislation. But it strikes me that even when Democrats feel like it's safe to talk about gun control, they don't really feel like it's safe to talk about the big stuff, the big ideas that they want, things like a gun ban.
Yeah. But I also got observing the fact that this was, you know, not planned to be released. My advice for all Democratic candidates out there is just assume that every single person you're speaking to is secretly working for James O'Keefe. All the gang at Veritas, you know, because history proves that a good 40% of us speak to somebody who's a James O'Keefe undercover operative. Three times a week or something like that. I exaggerate slightly, but look, this is an era of the ubiquitous, you know, everybody's got their cell phones and stuff like that. Remember Romney in the 47% comment, things that are said behind closed doors don't always stay behind closed doors. And you could lament this. You could say this is an invasion of privacy, but I think you could also say that this is edifying for the rest of us in the electorate, you know, to say we've always had a suspicion that Democrats would say one thing on the campaign stump, and then when push came to shove behind closed doors, that they'd have different beliefs. And this sort of thing, you know, solidifies it. And I think that, you know, for those who say, oh, Democrats are running on gun control this year, this is a very vivid example. You could say that you know, the Democrats who are running on, you know, for these House districts, by and large, are pro-gun control. If I'm a Second Amendment supporter in that district, I know who I'm voting for because, you know, the Democrat says, oh, I just want common sense gun legislation, and then gets very vague about what laws they support and what they – look, you know how that end story ends up. You can't count on that person to protect your rights. You know, I think you'll probably see this sort of thing, you know, probably in district after district. You know, Democrats, you know, those who support gun control, that's why they keep doing, you know, common sense and adjectives like this that sound good. I mean, they might as well just say – yeah, was it common sense gun control? No, it wasn't gun control. Gun sense. What was the name of the organization, Cam?
Every Time for Gun Safety.
Gun Safety. There you go. Like who could be, yes, against gun safety? It's not even about control anymore. It's just, you might just, right, call it good gun stuff, or, you know, good, you know, happy gun. You know, it's just like the most generic, wonderful sounding adjectives. You can't count on that because one person's concept of common sense might be very different from somebody else's. And that's, you know, what we've always seen in politics is, you know, people try to, you know, pose towards the middle and moderate and sensible. And then once they're in there, they vote as long as they can until they need your vote again. And in the case of the Senate, it's, you know, going to be every 6 years. In the case of the House, every two.
There you go, Mr. Jim Garrity from my National Review. Listen, buddy, we got to take a time out, unfortunately, but I appreciate you coming on the program. It's good talking with you as always, and look forward to doing this again in person here before long.
I look forward to that too, Cam. Take care.
All right, you too, sir. Jim Garrity, make sure you're following Jim on Twitter, at Jim Garrity, and reading Jim at nationalreview.com. Rob O'Donnell from Brothers Before Others is going to join us here in a couple of minutes. The ACLU, I don't know if you are aware of this, but I can tell you. So the ACLU had this piece on the Second Amendment, a quote, pro-liberty case for gun restrictions. Yes. Their tweet was, the wide availability of guns and their misuse is leading to restrictions on Americans' freedom. And that, they say, needs to be a part of the firearms debate. So in other words, if we just pass all kinds of gun control laws, then all of these other laws that the ACLU doesn't like would magically go away. That would be their argument. Well, Rob O'Donnell, law enforcement officer with Brothers Before Others, has been taking a look at this report. He has some things to say about it. So we'll talk about that with Rob right after a quick break. Stick around. Much more Cam and Company still to come.
This
right after
is
this.
Where it all begins, at the Last Great Coliseum, the Bristol Motor Speedway, on August 18th, 2018. This is where the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race will be kicking off. Behind me and all around us, these stands are going to be filled with screaming, cheering race fans, NRA members, folks who love this country. And you've got to be a part of this. There's not a bad seat in the house at the Bristol Motor Speedway. It's one of the things I love about this place. First of all, look at the view beyond the track from up here, the mountains in the distance. And those hills right there closer to the track, they're going to be filled with folks who are camping, who've been here all week long as part of race week. And then, again, you can't get any higher than where we are right now at the Bristol Motor Speedway. But if you look down, it's like you are on top of this track. Imagine 40 cars, bumper to bumper, jostling for position right there. And it's like... it's like you're watching it from right on top of the action. Now, if you wait for this checkered flag to wave, you're going to be too late to get your tickets to the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race. So you want to go ahead and you want to go to NRARaceTix.com now. You are going to get the lowest price for race tickets anywhere you can find it. 15% off for NRA members, any seat in the house, NRARaceTix.com. And when you get here to the Bristol Motor Speedway, there's all kinds of stuff to see and do, but make sure you actually come inside the Bruton Smith building. Make sure you shop here and get all of your cool merchandise for the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race. You've got stickers. You've got hats. You know I'm a big fan of hats, right? We've got koozies. We've got all kinds of great stuff. And really, the best thing that you're going to find here is the experience itself. There is nothing like the night race at the Last Great Coliseum. It's August 18th, 2018. We will see you in Bristol, baby, for the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race.
Everyone understands the importance of securing our public places. That's why every major corporate campus and office tower, every sporting event, celebrity award show, and government building, all of it, is protected by multiple layers of security. But when it comes to our most precious resource, not gold or oil or precious jewels, our children, we utterly fail to protect them at school every single day. Each day that goes by, our banks and businesses are better protected than our children. That's a national outrage. NRA's School Shield program has already made world-class security resources available to hundreds of American schools. It's free of politics, and it's free of charge. If your child's school isn't protected, ask them to call School Shield today. We're the National Rifle Association of America, guardians of our school children and freedom's safest place.
Our fans are super patriotic. We love that. Our fans are loyal, patriotic, and I have a brother that's in the military, so that kind of really hits close to home for us.
Thank you to the men and women out there fighting for our freedom. We wouldn't be here today doing what we do and driving race cars and being able to live out the dreams of our lives if it wasn't for you. So thank you for keeping our freedom free and fighting for all of us.
America lies at the end of the wilderness road, and our past is not a dead past, but still lives in us. Our forefathers had civilization inside themselves, the wild outside. We live in the civilization they created, but within us, the wilderness still lingers. What they dreamed, we live. And what they lived, we dream.
Welcome back to Cam and Company right here on NRA TV. Chad Dukes from 106.7 The Fan joining us in just a little bit. Right now, I want to welcome from Brothers Before Others, Mr. Rob O'Donnell is with us. Rob, good afternoon, sir.
How you doing, Cam?
Not as good as you, man. Look at that view behind you. That's absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, I figured I'd bring it out to the deck today.
Good for you. Good for you. One of these days, I'll do a show from the farm at some point, and we'll of course the day I pick it out, we'll probably have thunderstorms. Anyway, glad that the weather's cooperating for you. And a fascinating thread that you had on Twitter. So the ACLU comes out with this piece on. Gun restrictions in the name of freedom, right? Gun control in the name of freedom. And we know that the ACLU has been, to put it very charitably, spotty on the Second Amendment. At the national level, the organization did not join in the Heller case. It did not sign or file an amicus brief arguing in support of an individual right to keep and bear arms. Nationally, the ACLU has always seen the Second Amendment as sort of the bastard stepchild of the Bill of Rights. You've had some local chapters that have done great work with Second Amendment organizations around the country, but at the national level, not so much. And so they come out with this piece, again, arguing in favor of, let's say, they say the wide availability of guns and their misuse is leading to restrictions on Americans' freedom, and that, they say, needs to be a part of the privacy debate. So what say you, Rob O'Donnell?
Well, if you look at what the ACL stands for, you know, they tout their organization for almost 100 years. The ACLU has worked to defend and preserve the individual rights and liberties guaranteed by the Constitution. They need to change that to some individual rights after this piece. A pro-liberty case for gun restrictions from the ACLU, an organization that's sworn to protect the Constitution and our rights granted by it. The bullet points they lay out are even more troubling. You know, they use the common fear factors of you're going to live in a police state if we don't restrict and curtail this gun ownership in the nation. And they go from all-out hyperboil to hysteria to outright lies in some of their bullet points.
Yeah, so let's go through some of these bullet points, because you're right. The argument is because we have gun ownership in this country, it is leading to a police state, right? So they say increased physical searches, including ever-expanding checkpoints, bag searches, magnetometers, body scanners, pat-downs, and more. Call it the airportization of American life. They also talk about more surveillance. We've seen at least two school districts in the United States vote to adopt comprehensive surveillance systems that include blanket video surveillance, tracking, face recognition, and the ability of law enforcement to tap into the system. A growth in databases, watch lists, investigations, and background checks that set the government rummaging around in our personal lives. More armed police and guards at more civilian gatherings. More police shootings. All of this, again, apparently can go away if we just pass more gun control. But here's the thing, Rob. I mean, when you look at other countries around the globe that have very restrictive gun control policies in place, you know, I mean, you can make a really good case that the police state is actually far more powerful in those places than it is here, because you have to enforce those laws. I mean, you as a law enforcement officer know that better than almost anybody. Any law you put on the books, the ACLU, I guess, doesn't understand. I mean, they're worried about a police state, and yet they want to empower law enforcement to intrude even more into the private lives of American citizens in order to enforce these laws.
And when you break down their bullet points, you know, they use this, the airportation of our society. Well, the last time I checked, that was done with box cutters and turning airplanes into missiles, not for anyone owning a gun or had anything to do with guns. You know, that was the start off of the TSA and the whole checkpoints at that point, at that area. Surveillance in school districts, they bring up, you know, there are two school districts that are going to these extreme measures of using facial recognition and other means of surveillance and linking it to local police departments in case of emergencies. Well, in Pennsylvania alone, we have 520 school districts. I just did a quick check, and there's around 15,000 school districts across the country, and they're willing to curtail our Second Amendment rights based on two school districts that are working with the funding they have to do what they can. You know, they bring in the of course, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas with the clear backpacks. Again, with limited funding, they're looking for what they can do as fast as they can do it. And that may be one of them. If the ACLU wants to grant a couple hundred thousand dollars to that school district where they can institute magnetometers, where there's not such an invasion of their privacy by walking around with clear knapsacks, I'm sure that school district would gladly accept that.
I think that you're right. Now, one of the other things that the ACLU makes clear here in their pro-liberty case for gun restrictions, they don't actually talk at all about what restrictions they would support, Rob. I mean, that's kind of fascinating that, you know, look at what's happening here because we've got this access to firearms. But they don't actually get, I mean, the slightest bit specific. They don't offer up one a gun control policy that they would support as an organization.
No, the entire grasp of this article is if you want liberty in this country, we must restrict guns. I mean, that's the whole basis of this article. And like you said, there is absolutely no facts on what specifically they can do. You know, they talk big about the Constitution allows restrictions of firearms. Well, but they won't get in depth in the Heller decisions or decisions of such that say quite the opposite, if you want to use it in that fact. And then they go into the same old catch-all in the last bullet point, more police shootings, racist police shootings, police state, and it's just an outright lie. Shootings, law enforcement shootings in this country are at an all-time historic low.
Okay, so that makes another really good point that the ACLU doesn't actually bring up here, and it's something that the media doesn't really like to talk about. Gun control activists certainly don't talk about it. But violent crime, Rob, as you know, is about half what it was back in the early 1990s. Juvenile homicides have declined 66% since the early 1990s. Violence in schools has actually declined since the early 1990s and has done so considerably. And it's, you know, it's stupid, to put it bluntly, to have a policy discussion when you are unwilling or unable to consider basic facts like has the crime rate gone up or down over the past 25 years?
Oh, it's gone down.
Absolutely. But one side doesn't want to talk about it. The side that wants more laws on the books, in fact, not only doesn't want to talk about it, it's better for them if people think that crime is at an all-time high. It's better for them if people think that, you know, we've got mayhem on the streets because that way they can freak people out, and they say the answer again is more gun control laws. If they acknowledge that violent crime has been going down, well, at the same time we've had 16 million concealed carry holders, you now have over, I think, 400 million privately owned firearms in this country, and again, crime's been going down, I mean, that completely obliterates their basic fundamental belief of more guns equals more crime.
Well, that's where you get it. Their fundamental belief is what the end game they want. They want that goal of less guns. They want gun control, regardless of the facts, regardless of those statistics, regardless of the laws and Constitution. They want their end, which is less guns taken off the street, regardless if it helps the situation. That's why they target things they target. That's why these facts don't come out in the discussion, because they're afraid of them. The facts are their biggest enemy. Because if you sat down and said, all right, let's look at statistical facts, let's look at history, let's look at this from a holistic point of view to see where the common ground is, which they refuse to have. They block the common ground. Why would they want to talk about it?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, you're right. And then, you know, I don't know if you saw this story, nothing to do with the ACLU, but Baltimore, Rob, you and I have talked a lot about what's going on in Baltimore and the staggering high level of violence there. Baltimore City Council, you know, they watered down a bill last year that would have provided, I think, a year behind bars for anybody caught in illegal possession of a firearm. Mandated now no jail time upon a first offense. But they are cracking down, I don't know if you saw this, on kids being able to order soda with their meals at restaurants, Rob.
Yeah, because that's really going to help the safety and well-being of those kids that can barely walk to school because of the hails of bullets. Same thing, there's an article out today that D.C.'s looking to curtail their aggressive firearms unit that goes after illegal guns. And I linked my story to it, exactly what happened in Chicago. As soon as they disbanded these units, homicides and gun crime started to skyrocket.
And again, you're right. But unfortunately, we're at a point now where a lot of these policies, you know, I don't know how many people actually believe what they're saying. I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and assume that they do. They really seem to think that you can tell police, don't go after the most violent offenders. In fact, you can order police, don't go after the most violent offenders, don't go after the most active gangs. Instead, have a gun buyback, right? Instead, let's pass a law banning magazines over 10 rounds. And that's actually going to be more effective than policing that actually targets the problem, the worst of the worst offenders in any given community.
We keep crime data for a reason. We track these things for a reason. It's so you can go after that reason. And until they come to the realization that the facts are the facts and data is not discriminatory, and face those facts and go after that target, we're going to continue this seesaw up and down, back and forth, circle around the facts.
Rob O'Donnell with Brothers Before Others. Listen, man, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. It's always good talking with you.
Thanks, Cam.
You bet. Enjoy that sunny afternoon. Rob O'Donnell, make sure you're following Rob on Twitter as well, at @O'Donnell_Rob. Chad Dukes of 106.7 The Fan is going to join us in just a little bit. We'll talk about the idea that if football goes away, so too does America. Perhaps a little bit of hyperbole from the head coach of the University of North Carolina. But I mean, you actually are seeing moves across the country to ban football for those under the age of 12. I think you've got 4 states that are considering such a rule. I'll be honest with you, I don't know that it's likely to pass this year. But certainly no shortage of celebrities and even former athletes coming out and saying, hey, you know, I would let my kid play. I think it's good to talk about things like CTE and ways to make this a safe profession or a safer profession. But as we talk about with Chad Dukes, you know, basically any sport out there has the potential for injury. I mean, that's one of the things that, I won't say it's a primary reason why we watch sports. We watch sports because the athletes there are doing things that we can't do. Right? And we're amazed by it. We're impressed by it. We're entertained by it. But generally speaking, we're watching them do things that we could never do. Even if we'd like to tell ourselves that we could, deep down aside, we know we're probably not going to be as good as they are. But there's also that element of danger. I mean, in every sport, you're playing without a safety net. If you're playing baseball, you could get hit by a line drive. If, you know, you're cheerleading, you could blow out a knee very easily. If you're playing football, obviously you've got the potential of being injured every time you get tackled, every time you square off against a offensive or defensive lineman. There's no shortage of opportunities to be in. Even in soccer, you've got head injuries. So is this a matter of trying to, make the world so safe that we all end up living in bubbles? Do we have to get rid of things like football? Or are there ways to, I don't know, maybe approach this a little bit more calmly and rationally? I know that doesn't seem to be really the buzzwords these days, calm and rational. But we'll talk about it with Chad Dukes coming up here in just a minute or two. Stick around. We've got much more Cam and Company coming up right after this. So let's talk about broken windows policing and the nation's opioid crisis. I think this is a fascinating topic. And before we really get into it, can you just describe or define broken windows policing as a philosophy and as a policing tactic?
Yeah, it's actually very simple. So really, the name pretty much sums it up. If you fix the little things, the big things follow. So if you have a dilapidated neighborhood with broken windows and crumbling buildings, if you start to repair that and the neighborhood looks a little bit nicer, people start to take pride in it. As opposed to policing, if you arrest for the little things, the little vandalisms, the shopliftings, you start to fix the bigger things. You start to fix the if you arrest somebody, for example, for jumping a turnstile in the New York City subway, back when they had those, now they have big gated revolving doors. But if you arrest that shoplifter, you might find that you close warrants on two felony robberies. And so when you start making the neighborhoods look better and you're taking the quality of life crimes off the street, overall crime reduces. And that was a very, very effective policy deployed in the early 1990s around the country that saw a steep reduction in crime implemented first in New York City by Rudy Giuliani and then Police Commissioner William Bratton.
Okay, so this is not a matter of putting a bunch of new laws on the books. It's not a matter of, you know, we got to go after America's gun owners. This is a matter of emphasizing the enforcement of these lower-level offenses.
Yeah, this isn't even a legislative solution. This is a criminological philosophy. So this is really just a theory being implemented into practice. It doesn't require any new laws, doesn't require any policy changes from a police department standpoint.
Yeah, which is one reason why anti-gun lawmakers probably aren't on board with this generally, because it doesn't allow them to say, look, we did something, because they have to say that the police are doing
something. That's exactly right. Yep.
Yeah. So how does this apply then to the opioid epidemic? What would it look like if we're applying these principles to fighting the staggering and growing number of Americans who are dying from opioids?
Right. You know, I think that requires a combination of both. And so it's very interesting. I've been talking to experts for my show on all sides of this. And so where broken windows would come in handy is if we could get the addicts off of the streets for minor violations. Nobody wants to criminalize addiction. But if we could convert, so for example, someone's an addict and they go and they shoplift to pay for the drugs. Well, we don't want to send this person to prison because they're not a hardened criminal. We don't want to make them worse. But if we could combine the arrest, and then instead of making it a criminal charge, converting it into a civil commitment. So they have to go to a detox facility, then a treatment facility, then a halfway house. In the long run, and I was torn on it, but now I'm firmly convinced, in the long run, we start to save tremendous amounts of money. We get people off of these drugs. At the same time, we're eliminating the minor crimes that might become major crimes. So that's where I think that if we were to deploy broken windows, in very broad strokes, we could start to make a bit of a dent in the opioid epidemic. We have to do that, though, with the rigid enforcement of the major-level drug dealers, the doctors who write scripts indiscriminately, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and increasingly now the drug cartels this is something else I think that we're fighting here is the law of unintended consequences. Oftentimes, John, you'll hear gun control advocates say, I think it's ridiculous. I have to show more ID for my cold medicine than I do to get a gun, which is baloney. In the first place.
Right?
Yeah, it's absolute nonsense. But the reason why you got to show your ID when you want the pseudoephedrine or the high-test cold medicines is because back in the 90s, people were using that to manufacture meth. The pseudoephedrine was a precursor chemical. Right.
Yeah, they still are. You know?
But we said, if we make it harder to get that, then we won't have these homegrown meth labs. The homegrown meth labs, as you say, they're still around. They're not as many as there were. But the Mexican drug cartels saw the opening of the market. They said, well, we can make this stuff. We don't have to worry about our meth labs blowing up. So they've got, the corrupt port officials. They're importing the precursor chemicals. They found a way to make it more pure and cheaper. And now meth is more widely available than it was back in the 1990s.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. But we are seeing, this administration is probably the most proactive presidential administration I've ever seen with regards to the enforcement on the cartels in specific. There are multi-agency task forces that do nothing all day long but hunt down the cartels, and they're making a dent. The bigger problem is what you said. It's the meth, but it's also the legal pharmaceuticals like fentanyl that make their way to the street. That's what's really killing people.
Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV. Cam Edwards, your host. All right. Jim Wallace of the Gun Owners is actually going to join us next hour. We'll talk about protests outside of a courthouse in Massachusetts now. People are actually starting to get fed up with these light sentences given to violent criminals. Colian's been talking a lot about this here on NRA TV as well, highlighting some of the light sentences that incredibly violent criminals have received and a justice system that oftentimes appears to favor the criminal over the victim. Or the citizenry. We'll talk about that with Jim Wallace coming up next hour. Right now, I want to share with you a conversation with Mr. Chad Dukes, sports talk show host at 106.7 The Fan in Washington, D.C., talking all about this comment by the University of North Carolina head football coach Larry Fedora, who says if football disappears, so too will America. Take a look and a listen. Mr. Dukes, sir, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Cam, always my pleasure. How are you?
I am excellent. I might be in better shape than football, actually. North Carolina head football coach Larry Fedora, according to USA Today, said our game is under attack. I fear the game will be pushed so far from what we know that we won't recognize it 10 years from now. And if it does, our country will go down too. Now he's talking, of course, about the. I'm not sure, Chad, what he means about the country going down if football goes down. So I'll ask you, what's Larry Fedora talking about?
Well, football is, baseball is America's pastime, but football is indubitably America's sport. I don't think you have. I mean, he's being dramatic, and hopefully there's some hyperbole here, but I don't think you have to stretch too far, Cam, to think that there is an attack on fundamental American values. And if you believe that you can equate those values to something that football is, and there's a lot of those values inside the game of football. When you talk about teamwork, when you talk about family, when you talk about unity, I think a lot of those aspects of our society do find themselves under attack currently. So maybe he was speaking symbolically that if we lose this one thing, then we're going to lose a chunk of what America is, and there might be some validity in there.
There might be, and he's also talking, I think specifically he was talking about, he said he was concerned about how the idea that football concussions lead to CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, has and will affect people's perception of the sport. He says, I think because of the lessons you learn in the game of football relate to everything that you're going to do for the rest of your life. When we stop learning those lessons, we're going to struggle. And, I suppose we could switch to flag football, Chad. I don't know that I'll have quite the same draw. But, it's interesting because we're obviously having this discussion about the violence done to the human brain when you're playing football. And you don't have to get to the NFL level to see that. But my soon-to-be 18-year-old played soccer all in high school, and you're taking soccer balls to the head. Sometimes you're clunking your head against another player. Like that, too, there's some risk. There's some risk in cheerleading. There's risk in baseball. I wonder at what point do we decide it's too much of a risk to subsidize these athletic activities, Chad?
It's a great point, and it's the same argument. I remember hearing Adam Carolla, who's a bit of a conservative, he had a guy on his podcast, and he was talking about nuclear power and how nuclear power is safer than what we have, and it's efficient, and we should be using it. He's like, well, why aren't we? People don't want it. People have gotten it in their heads that it's unsafe, and their dogs are going to have two tails, and that's just become common thinking. So if that's the same thing with football, how is it any different than every time I go to the store and I want a tissue, I say, where's the Kleenex? Every time I order a soda, I say, I want a Coke. Like, that's just something that's in my brain. And if we teach people that if you play football, you're going to get CTE and you're going to shoot yourself in the chest, well, if that just becomes what people believe about the sport, then the sport will go away. Like, nuclear power has gone away. And, what's the most dangerous thing to kids, Cam? It's pools. Kids die in pools all the time, but all we hear and scream about is guys driving around in panel vans, firearms, all this different stuff, because that's just what the popular thinking has become. So if we equate football with dementia and CTE and suicide, and that just becomes what people think without knowing the actual hard facts, well, then that is what it will be.
Talking again with Chad Dukes from 106.7, The Fan. So when football goes away, Chad, what are you going to be talking about in the fall?
Oh, I'll be out of business. We're in Washington, D.C. here, Cam, or as I broadcast. And as cute as the All-Star game was, the Redskins are the bread and butter. Everybody knows that. And I don't think there will be a call for – think about sports talk radio in the South and the Bible Belt. It's probably 70% college football. If there's no college football, it goes away. There's not that appetite for hockey or tennis or any other sport you want to point at. I doubt I would have an industry if football went away.
There are a lot of folks. You're right. I mean, this obviously not just the athletes and the coaches, but the trainers, the concession workers. I mean, that's the thing, right? I mean, you're talking about a huge, huge industry, and it seems to me like it would be much easier to look at ways to reform the industry, maybe, you know, try to cut down on the risks that the athletes are taking. That seems to me to be a much easier haul than simply saying it's time for football to go.
I just don't think there's as the people, the players that are saying that I'm glad I played football, that I would let my kids play football, that it's important that my kids play football. They're not being given, how many times have we talked about this, Cam? They're not being given the same platform as the ones that are saying it's got to go. And I think, and this is just my theory, you have a lot of people that are in the media that maybe didn't spend a lot of time on a football field. Like maybe they spent a lot of time working for the school paper or working for the school band or being in theater, and they don't much care for football to begin with. And now they're sitting here with a bit of a poison pen. I think that's something that needs to be discussed that probably isn't as well, whenever the topic of agenda comes up, which it so often does with the press as of
late. Well, so, I mean, I almost got the sense here, Chad, that what you're saying is that football has almost become, maybe it has become, maybe there's no almost about it. It's become a part of that, quote-unquote, toxic masculinity that simply needs to go away, or so we are told.
Absolutely. I think that one of the most valuable lessons that I learned, I played football when I was a kid, and the most valuable lesson it taught me was I was scared of it. I was scared to play football. I was scared to get hurt. And when I went out there and was getting tackled and getting knocked around and pushed around, I realized I'm not going to die. This is something that I can do. I don't know if I can do it all that well, but I can do it. That's an incredibly valuable lesson. I think a lot of people haven't learned that lesson. They haven't been able to figure out, you know, that this is a violent thing that you can overcome, that you can partake in. And because of that, there's a fear surrounding it, an intimidation factor. So I think there's a lot of reasons why there's a lot of people out there that would be very happy if there was no more football.
I can tell you I learned perseverance. I learned not to quit or give up. And I learned that losing sucks. I learned that lesson a lot, Chad, playing high school football, because I think we won an average of about 2 games a year.
Sounds like Lake Braddock when I was there.
Yeah, and you want to talk about fear? Let me tell you, when you're 5'8", and at that point, I think .175, and you're squaring off. I was a lineman, Chad. I was a lineman at 5'8" and 175 in high school, and we were a small Catholic school, and because of our size, we couldn't play any of the big schools in Oklahoma City, so we would play the small farm towns outside of Oklahoma City. So inevitably, here I am at 5'8", 175, going up against somebody who's 6'3", 230, 240. Yeah, I learned fear very, 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 very well my first couple of years in high school.
And I'll say this, you probably have a similar story. You know, I've accomplished a little bit in my life, and I've done some cool things. And I had a stripped, I'll never forget it. I sit here picturing it. I had a stripped sack fumble. I wasn't a great football player either, and I wasn't the best athlete, but I'll never forget that. That's the highlight of my life, going out there and playing that scary sport and being able to do something that helped your team and hear cheers like that. There's nothing that can be recreated with any of the financial success I've had or speaking into a larger audience. Like, there's things that you just can't compare, and that's one of them. That memory is worth more than a lot of the money I've made over my career. So, you know, take that away at your own risk.
Mr. Chad Dukes from 106.7 The Fan, thank you as always, sir. Good talking with you today.
Thanks for letting me slum up the joint, Cam. I always appreciate you having me on.
Anytime, my friend. We'll do it again soon. Chad Dukes with us here on Cam and Company. And we will, I guess, continue to follow this. I'm sure as we get closer to football season, the topic is going to heat up along with the national anthem and other football-related stories. Eventually might even get around to talking about the games come fall at some point, probably around the time playoffs start. Now, coming up next, our Jim Wallace of the Gun Owners Action League joins us on the program. Also, Stella Morabito on what to learn from the social justice warrior who was eaten by his own mob. Now, this refers to an essay written pseudonymously by somebody who says, listen, I was on the left. I was the type of person that when I could jump on this online outrage kick, I would. And I got a lot of pleasure from it. It made me feel good. It made me feel like I was making a difference. I'm calling out these horrible, awful people. until he became the horrible, awful person. And all of a sudden realized, oh, well, maybe these people aren't so horrible and awful after all. Maybe it's just the outrage machine. And now I'm not a part. Now I'm still a part of it. I'm just on the other side of this. Yeah. How about that? One of the latest examples of this, by the way, is the actor and director and writer Mark Duplass, who you may remember from the FX show The League, right? And so Mark Duplass, who is of the left, on the left, tweeted out something yesterday because he's trying to be more civil. I think he's got this, like, it's some hashtag, like 365 days of kindness or something like that. And so one of the things that he did to demonstrate his kindness and his civility was he sent out a tweet. He said, hey, you know, if you were looking to follow somebody from the other side, because, again, he's on the left and most of his followers are, too. But if you're on the left, you're looking to follow somebody on the right who is thoughtful and, you know, worth following. Follow Ben Shapiro. I haven't had a lot of interactions with him, he said, but the times that I have, he's been a stand up kind of guy. And so you don't have to agree with him. I don't agree with him all the time, but give him a follow. And that's all it took. That is all it took for blue-checked Twitter and non-blue-checked Twitter and Mark Duplass's fans to start calling out, how dare you? You really? No, you can't do that. I know other conservatives that I mean, it was, it's what you get on social media. You offer up an opinion, and most of the time, people are not going to second it. They might like it if they agree with you, but they're not going to chime in and say, yeah, way to go. You get some of that, but not a lot. Most of the time, you're just going to get more grief for expressing your opinion. And Mark Duplass certainly did. And he backed down. He deleted his tweet, in which he indicated, hey, follow Ben Shapiro, even if you're on the left. You might get something out of it. And then he posted a big, long statement about 4 hours ago on his Twitter feed, quote, so that tweet was a disaster on many levels. I want to be clear that I in no way endorse hatred, racism, homophobia, xenophobia, or any such form of intolerance. I don't know why anybody would think that he did or does. But that's where the mob goes. That's where the outrage machine goes, right? It can't just be that they disagree with you because we're allowed to disagree with one another. We live in a free society. We are allowed to express an opinion and somebody else says, yeah, you know, I don't agree with that. Okay. And that's how it works. I don't agree with that. Okay. And you can choose to engage and, well, let me try to change your mind, or you can choose to say, okay, and walk away. But not if you're part of the outrage mob. Somebody can express an opinion, and that opinion is somehow wrong. And that opinion must somehow be eradicated. And that opinion you must be shamed for until you recant and apologize, which is what Mark Duplass has done. Quote, my goal has always been to spread unity, understanding, and kindness, but I'm going to make mistakes along the way. Apparently saying, hey, you know what? The interactions I've had with Ben Shapiro seems like a pretty good dude. Should give him a follow. That's a mistake. Can't just be an opinion. It's a mistake. Sometimes, Mark Duplass writes, I move too quickly when I get excited or I fail to do enough research or I don't communicate myself clearly. I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry for having the opinion that I had. Please don't hurt me anymore. I now understand that I need to be more diligent and careful. I'm working on that. But I do believe deeply in bipartisan understanding, and I will continue to do my best to promote peace and decency in this world right now. That said, I hear you. And I want to say thank you to those who reached out with constructive criticism. Of what? Of his opinion. Right? And Mark Duplass says, and I have genuinely learned so much and wish everyone all the best. Please don't hurt me. Please leave me alone. I got to say, I mean, nothing surprises me anymore. But you want to talk about lacking the courage of your convictions. And Mark Duplass is the poster child for that. Again, all he said was, hey, I don't agree with everything Ben Shapiro says, but the interactions I've had with him seems like a decent dude. You should give him a follow. I'm really sorry I now understand I need to be more diligent and careful. Sometimes I move too quickly when I get excited. I don't communicate myself clearly. I'm working on it. It's sad to see. It's sad. Do you remember that song, Katie? You're probably too young for this, but I don't know. Maybe when you were in middle school. Do you remember the band Bowling for Soup, Katie? Yeah? Do you remember the song? They had their big song in 1985, I think it was. And then their next album, their single, wasn't a big hit, was called High School Never Ends. Do you remember that song? No? Do you remember they did the theme to Phineas and Ferb? You're probably young enough to remember that. Probably young enough to have watched Phineas and Ferb. Yeah, yeah, see, I knew that. Anyway, they had a song called High School Never Ends. And I just thought of that as I'm reading this. The peer pressure that you may have experienced in high school. That's social media for you right now. And if you express an opinion and the mob comes after you, you're going to be strong enough to stand your ground? You're going to be like Mark Duplass and bend to the will of the mob. Stick around. Hour two of Cam and Company is coming up next.
These are dangerous and challenging times for the Second Amendment. We face an enemy that is willing to spend whatever it takes to drown out our voice and disgrace the name of our great association and our members. They don't just want to ban every semi-automatic firearm in America. They want to repeal the Second Amendment once and for all. For any other organization, these challenges would be too much to face. But the NRA has fought through times like these before. And we know how to win. Back in the 90s, Bill Clinton waged war on gun owners and the Second Amendment. He banned entire classes of semi-automatic firearms. And he thought he had us on the run. But NRA members and Charlton Heston fought back with a principled fury that rallied the entire nation. We taught Bill Clinton a lesson that both his wife and Barack Obama would have been wise to follow. Don't mess with the National Rifle Association of America. No organization has a more proven track record of doing what it takes to win in the toughest times than the NRA. And this is a time for warriors. In times like these, we don't shrink and we don't run. We ready ourselves for battle and get stronger than ever before. This time is no exception. I am proud to announce Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North as the next president of the National Rifle Association of America. I can think of no one better to serve in this critical position. Oliver North is a legendary warrior for American freedom, a gifted communicator, and a skilled leader. He's an unflinching, unapologetic defender of Second Amendment freedom who has earned the enduring respect and admiration of our members. And he strikes genuine fear into the freedom-hating political elites who so desperately wish for a weakened NRA. He understands what all the so-called Washington and media experts still don't. That the strength of this organization will always and forever come from our nearly 6 million members. They can outspend us 1,000 to 1. They can have every talk show, every celebrity, and every elitist college professor in the country. But they will never, ever convince the American people to give up their freedom. So do you. The almost 6 million members of the National Rifle Association of America, it has been the honor of my life to serve you for all these years, and we're not done yet. I am proud to report that we have never been stronger, never been more energized, and never been more equipped with strong and courageous and battle-proven leaders. And to all of those who dream of stealing the freedom of every law-abiding American, you'd be wise to take a lesson from Bill Clinton, Al Gore, John Kerry, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and every other political retiree who picked the wrong fight with the wrong people. We're the toughest defender of individual freedom this country's ever seen. And we are, now and forever, freedom's safest place.
TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour two of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, starts now. In the next 60 minutes, Jim Wallace of the Gun Owners Action League up in Massachusetts on the protests over lenient sentences outside of one courthouse there in Massachusetts. Also, Estella Morbido writing to the Federalist, what to learn from the social justice warrior who was eaten by his own mob. Next hour, Norris Swiden joins us from Warrior One out in San Bernardino, California. A guy walked in back in February to Norris's shop, and you know, I think he had sunglasses on, had his big beard. I think he had a denim vest on, had longer hair, and walked in, and Norris thought, it didn't look right. Guy starts talking. Norris says, you're that Borat guy, aren't you? And all of a sudden, this guy had somewhere else he needed to be. Yeah, interesting. And now, of course, Sacha Baron Cohen has his new show out, going after all kinds of folks. And Norris saw through the disguise. In fact, we talked about this with Cameron Gray, who is off today and tomorrow. But, you know, again, Cameron Gray got a letter calling him like one of the, it was like 70 for 70 or something like that, right? And you're one of the 70 most influential voices for Israel, right alongside Tony Blair and others. And we want to honor you, Cameron Gray, if you'll just come here. We're going to be in D.C. taping, and we just want to, and Cameron Gray saw this as what it was as well, and took a flyer on that, that request. So it can happen, but what happens when Sacha Baron Cohen walks into your gun store? We'll talk about that with Norris Swiden coming up in hour three. Also coming up in hour three, Mr. Kurt Schlichter, talking about some of the big stories of the day and of the week. We also are following more of the latest Second Amendment news and information all across the nation. I mentioned last hour when we were talking with Jim Garrity about the latest out of New York 21, where Tedra Cobb, the Democrat running for Congress there, has, according to the Adirondack Daily Enterprise, quote, clarified her position on supporting a quote-unquote assault weapons ban. And it's honestly the clearest statement that Tedra Cobb has made was the one that she made when she thought she wasn't being recorded. I mean, that's just the case. Because there she was really upfront, really straightforward, talking to those kids who were gun control supporters. And she said, yeah, I was at this luncheon today, and a woman asked me, or told me, I want to ban these assault rifles. What do you think? And Tedra Cobb says, yeah, I'd like to ban them too, but I can't say that publicly. And the woman said, I wish you would. And I told her, I can't say that. I'll lose the election. And then threw out the name of a Moms Demand Action staffer in New York State and said, she told me, if I say I support banning these guns, I'm not going to win the elections. I can't say anything. That is pretty straightforward. I want to ban those guns. If I say that publicly, I'll lose the election. Since then, we've gotten a couple of statements from Tedra Cobb. The first one was this, quote, there are a lot of common sense things we need to do right now to make our kids safer without getting stuck on a stalemate issue like an assault weapons ban that would not pass this Congress and would not get signed by this president. It's a moot point, and voters in the North Country know that. Now, see, here again, that's not, first of all, she doesn't express her particular point of view. It's just, it's a moot point, right? So it doesn't matter what I think, because even if I get elected, you know, that wouldn't pass. President wouldn't sign it. So why even bother asking me about it? I mean, it's a pretty ham-fisted attempt to try to, you know, get past this. And I don't think it worked. Again, her campaign manager ends up resigning afterwards. But here's the thing. So she was questioned more about this. And she told her previous campaign manager, said that Tedra Cobb could not speculate on how she would vote on hypothetical legislation. Now, see, that's just a really dumb way to try to get out of this. As a candidate, what are you doing? You're talking about what you would do if you're elected. Here's what I would support. Here's what I wouldn't support. And for Tedra Cobb to say first, well, look, it's a moot point because, yeah, I don't think an assault weapons ban is going to get signed by the president. It should never get into law. Okay, what about every other position? I mean, again, you're running as a Democrat. President Trump's going to be there. If you get elected, he's going to be there for your entire first term. So what other things are a moot point? Talking about, you know, expanding Medicare, is that a moot point because the president would never agree to it? What about abolishing ICE? Is that a moot point because the president would never agree to it? I mean, Democrats took a pass on voting yay or nay on that yesterday as well, but that's just a dumb argument. You tell the voters, hey, if you elect me, here's what I'm going to do. And Tedra Cobb is saying, I can't talk about what I would do. Ha, 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 because then you won't elect me. So that didn't work out either. That statement by her campaign manager, well, she just can't talk about hypothetical situations. So we get another statement. This is now statement number three. New campaign manager for Tedra Cobb. And the paper again asked her, well, okay, since you won't talk about legislation that you might actually vote on, could you talk about legislation that, which by the way is another hypothetical, how would you have voted in 1994 for the Clinton gun ban? Now, again, you want to talk about a hypothetical? There's a hypothetical for you. Tedra Cobb cannot go back to 1994. There is no possible way that Tedra Cobb can vote on the Clinton gun ban of 1994. But she's willing to answer that hypothetical for some reason. And what she said was, quote, the 1994 assault weapons ban was well-meaning but very flawed. It created a new class of weapons and products for the market and did nothing to prevent the circumstances that led to murders at Sandy Hook, Virginia Tech, Parkland, Fort Hood, Santa Fe, and too many others to mention. There is a safe and sane way forward for people with goodwill and common sense. What that safe and sane way is going forward, she doesn't say. She doesn't say. Just leaves it as vague and innocuous as possible. How is that providing any sort of clarity? Again, the most clear and concise comments Tedra Cobb has made so far regarding gun bans are the ones that she made when she didn't think anybody was listening. That's when she was actually honest. That's when she was forthright. She said, yeah, I support it. I just can't say it publicly because I'll lose if I do. As far as I know, as far as I can tell, that's the real position that Tedra Cobb holds. And every other statement that's come out since then has just been an attempt to obfuscate from that. Now, I don't know if there are any local upstate New York reporters who might be tuning in this afternoon. If anybody from the Post Star newspaper is there, you guys are doing an awful job of covering the story, by the way. I just have to throw it out there. But here's another question. Since there are apparently only some hypotheticals that Tedra Cobb will answer, but she will answer hypothetical questions about how she would have voted for bills that have already come up. Ask her about the New York Safe Act. Ask her what she thinks about the New York Safe Act. If you were a state senator, if you were an assembly person, when the New York Safe Act came up in 2013, with its semi-auto ban, with its magazine restrictions, would you have voted for it? Do you support it? As a New Yorker, do you support repealing it? Because, again, New York 21, that's a part of the state where, even though it's been 5 years now since the SAFE Act was passed, you will still see in yards, and not just here and there, but a lot of them, the No SAFE Act signs. They haven't come down. Or if they've come down, they've been replaced and new signs have gone up. And I'd love to hear Tedra Cobb explain or attempt to explain how she would have voted for the New York SAFE Act. These gun laws that are currently in place in New York that each and every one of the folks that she is hoping to represent have to abide by. And frankly, you know, Tedra Cobb called the 1994 Clinton gun ban well-meaning but very flawed. By the way, this is also, that's how the gun control activists like to describe it now. back in 2004 when that ban was sunsetting, because it had a 10-year limit, and then Congress could vote to extend it, or they could just let it expire, and they just let it expire. And even then, gun control activists weren't really pushing that hard to renew it, because they just know they knew that there wasn't the support there to do that. Now, what they were arguing is, well, okay, so the ban really wasn't effective. It, you know, weren't a lot of crimes committed with these guns beforehand. There weren't a lot of crimes committed with these guns during the ban. Probably aren't going to be a lot of guns committed with these crimes after the ban goes away either. But if we really want it to be effective, it can't be as flawed as it has been. There are too many loopholes. There are too many exemptions. As Tedra Cobb writes, the 94 gun ban, quote, created a new class of weapons and products for the market. And that's, again, what gun control advocates were arguing. Well, because there were these loopholes here, manufacturers just followed the law, but they still kept producing firearms that we don't like. So if we have a new ban, it needs to be bigger and broader. It needs to ban these firearms that we don't like. No, by the way, they could make it really easy. They could write a ban on semi-automatic firearms, right? I mean, there's nothing stopping them from doing that. They don't have to name by model or name by feature or say, well, if you've got one of these cosmetic features and it's an assault weapon, they don't have to do any of that. They could write a piece of legislation that would ban any semi-automatic long gun. I don't think it would go well. Might be able to get it through the California legislature. Probably through New Jersey, too. But it would be a really tough haul across the nation. And it would be a very obvious tell that the gun control groups really aren't interested in gun safety. It's not about common sense gun safety regulations. It's about banning guns. And right now, their push is to sound moderate, to be moderate, at least in their public statements, which is why groups like Moms Demand Action, which have backed Tedra Cobb there in New York's 21st District, even though Tedra Cobb is, you know, obviously does not want to go on the record publicly as saying, yeah, I support a gun ban, there are no gun control groups calling her out. There's not a single gun control group out there saying, hey, you know what? We think Tedra Cobb needs to level with voters. This is the year that it's okay to run on gun control. This is the year where we can talk about common sense gun safety measures and voters aren't going to be turned off by it. So Tedra Cobb, say what you mean. If you're telling people in private that you support this gun ban, why won't you say that in public? Go ahead and stand with us. Gun control advocates aren't saying that at all. What they're saying about Tedra Cobb is, well, we support our candidates using a wide variety of practices and policies to reduce gun violence. So, you know, if she doesn't want to get specific about a gun ban, that's okay with us. Really. It's okay with them because this is, again, a district that's currently held by a Republican that they're trying to flip. And it's a pretty strong pro-Second Amendment district. If there were, let's say, just for giggles, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez came out and said, yeah, you know, I know I had on this platform of mine I wanted to ban ARs, but I've been doing some thinking. And, yeah, I think if we just do that, we're going to empower the state. And it's going to mean, more stop and frisks on young minority men in New York City. And it's going to lead to, more authoritarian practices by the police. And so, yeah, I can't get down with this gun ban after all. I don't support this AR ban. Oh, you know, the gun control groups would be reacting then. If this were coming from a politician in a deep blue city, running for a deep blue seat, and they dare to suggest that they didn't back a gun ban, yeah, the gun control groups would have problems with that. But in purple districts, or in districts that are currently red and they're hoping to flip to blue, you don't want to talk about a gun ban? Great. That's great. In fact, we kind of encourage that. And by the way, don't call it gun control. Ever. Call it common sense gun safety. That's it. That's the catchphrase. And again, that's what's going on in New York's 21st congressional district. I said when the story broke, I thought the story was going to have legs. I didn't know how much media attention it was going to get locally. And again, there are some papers that are really just doing their utmost to not cover this story. But this is one of those things, it's kind of the word of mouth. You know, word gets out that a candidate is not being honest, that a candidate is saying one thing behind closed doors and something else in public. And you don't need an op-ed to tell you this, because chances are your neighbor told you this, or one of the people you work with told you this, or the last time you went to the range, or you went to the gun store, somebody told you, hey, did you hear about this? And here we are now, a little bit more than, a week and a day after this story first broke. And in New York's 21st Congressional District, this shows no sign of actually abating, or certainly not enhancing, Tedra Cobb's chances for election there. Despite what the gun control advocates are saying about it now being safe to talk about gun control, not if you want to win. Can't talk about it. Certainly can't call it gun control. And you really, again, you want to stay away from any mention of those gun bans. All right, when we come back here on Cam and Company, Jim Wallace of the Gun Owners Action League, talking about the protests outside of the New Bedford court there in Massachusetts, protests over the lenient sentences handed out to repeat violent offenders, all the while elected officials in Massachusetts seem way more interested in going after and prosecuting and persecuting illegal gun owners than they do in actually addressing these violent criminals who keep getting out on low amounts of bail and low amounts of bond. We'll delve into this topic with Jim Wallace right after a quick break, so stick around. Much more Cam and Company coming up next.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free.
When I wrote God Bless USA in 1983 in the back of my bus, it was full of my heart. It was full of what I meant to say about where I came from. If tomorrow the things were gone, I'd work for all my life. I wanted to say I'm proud to be an American because I felt very proud of my country. And it had been a long time since I heard anybody say that. We're a melting pot of people who find it difficult to say something about all of us together collectively. And that's why I wanted to say I'm proud to be an American, whatever an American is. You know, it's from Japanese to Irish to English to German, you name it. We are Americans together. And lastly, I won't forget the men who died for our freedom. We do travel the world with God Bless the USA with the military. And I've done 30 USO tours. So no matter what country we're in, I'm usually under the safeguard of the United States military. And I've only come under fire a couple of times. But if every citizen in America knew that that's the kind of danger our troops are in, they'd have a little bit more respect for the danger, particularly this war on terror, which is more jungle warfare and desert warfare, where you don't know where the enemy is and who they are.
And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that life to me.
Well, everybody knows Bristol is a very different track than any other NASCAR track. Everybody has a beer cooler and they're dragging it into the stadium, and they know they're going to be there for a long time after the race. A lot of camaraderie, a lot of pre-race stuff, a lot of after-race stuff is kind of fun. And in the setting of East Tennessee, there in Bristol, where it's such surrounded by such beautiful stuff, thank God for sports events in this country. To see a night race there is a little special, because I think you have to be engaged as a fan. At night, you kind of get the whole magic of it all, even if you're not a fan. The amount of people who believe that America is the greatest country on earth and are proud to display it at that track, oh my gosh, you just have to go to Bristol and see it. I mean, you know, there are bigger tracks, there are bigger arenas, but Bristol's the place to come and see the display of Americanism. Fantastic.
More people dream of moving to America than any other country in the world. It's true. 150 million people would drop everything to come here, if they could, because they desperately want what so many of our leaders seek to destroy: the freedom to speak your mind, worship your God, build a business, leave a legacy, and defend your life and your loved ones. These are the basic building blocks of the American dream, an idea that still captivates human hearts like nothing else. In this time of such uncertainty and doubt, we must hold fast to the principles of freedom. For it is with these timeless ideas, not the elites who scorn them, where the hope of mankind still rests. We're the National Rifle Association of America, champions of civil rights and freedom's safest place.
I'm a law-abiding citizen who's never shot anybody, never committed a serious crime, never committed a felony. But it seems like every time we have one of these shootings, nobody wants to put the blame where it goes, which is at the shooter's feet. You want to put it at my feet.
I felt like I needed to say something for all the people out there that I just spoke about, the people who have come together, who are together, who feel unified, that majority of people who obey the law, you know, and work hard every day, and are just tired of people trying to pull them apart and pull them in all different directions. I think there's millions of me across the country, and I'm hoping that each one of those people will go out and tell these politicians we're not going to take it, and we're going to stand up for our rights, and we're going to hold on to them. Anyone who is concerned with holding on to the Second Amendment, I absolutely think they should join the NRA.
Bristol Motor Speedway, the place where you can forget about work for a while. Celebrate the good old USA and take in the best bumper banging, fist waving, hero making short track race of the year, the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race. It's America's night race. This is what you live for. So be there August 18th. It ain't just another race. It's Bristol, baby.
Welcome back to Cam and Company. Glad you've joined us. Stella Morabito of the Federalist joins us here in about 20 minutes or so. And an hour from now, Nora Swiden joins us from Warrior One in San Bernardino, California. We'll talk about the day that Sacha Baron Cohen came into his store, yes, in disguise. Jim Wallace of the Gun Owners Action League in Massachusetts joins us on the program right now. However, Jim, good afternoon, sir.
Jim, welcome back to the Second Amendment Battleground State.
I appreciate you coming on the program, and I got to tell you, I was pleasantly surprised to see this story today from a WBSM. Protests over lenient sentences begin outside of the New Bedford court. This was a yesterday morning protest organized by members of Neighborhoods United, which is an organization of 12 New Bedford neighborhoods associations and crime watch groups. It was a small gathering, as the media noted. Jerry Pinto of Neighborhoods United asking for more people to join the organization at the next protest. He says that second chances handed out to violent and habitual criminals through light sentences and low bails have been putting communities at risk. Now, first of all, Jim, we're not even really talking about second chances. We're talking about third, fourth, 10th, 110th chances in some cases there in Massachusetts.
Well, apparently the more problems you have, the more chances you have. What do they call that, a bulk deal? So, you know, you used to have the deal of the day, and we have a social media following called Mass Court Fails. And it seems like the worse your record is, the better deal you can get somehow. I don't know how that's working, but it seems to be the way it's working.
Seems to be. But, you know, again, we are actually seeing this, Jim. People are noticing this, which, I mean, I got to tell you, we've done the, you know, our deal of the day segment for 14 years here on Cam and Company. Every day, coming up with a different story from the criminal justice system where, you know, there's a sweetheart plea deal given. And honestly, this is one of the first times that I can, if not the first time that I can recall, hearing about protests outside of a county courthouse where citizens are just getting fed up. I mean, we know that this happens, but it typically doesn't get covered in the local press. People, I think, are largely unaware of this. Unfortunately, you know, you in Massachusetts, you've had to deal with the deaths of Officer Sean Gannon, the death of the police officer in Weymouth, Massachusetts over the weekend. And so there have been some high profile crimes committed by individuals who have gotten these sweetheart deals. And I think that's really the only reason why we're actually seeing the public even aware of this issue.
Well, I think you hit on it, because it's not, you know, the inner city crime like Chicago and Boston or Springfield or L.A. You know, these are hitting home in other places, so people are paying more attention to it. I mean, if somebody got murdered in Chicago, nobody would probably pay any attention to it, because they don't. But now that it's happening in the suburbs and police officers are being killed, finally they're paying attention. And unfortunately, Cam, what we're facing is a culture that just doesn't want to punish anybody anymore for anything they do. And I there's actually a small movement in Massachusetts to actually close down all of the prisons and jails. They don't want anybody put away anymore. And I can tell you firsthand, I've had discussions with legislators, especially from the inner cities, that they want stricter gun control laws. But when I say, well, why don't we just punish the criminals, they'll tell you flat out, no, we're not doing that anymore. That we've had enough of that. We've had enough of people going to prison. It doesn't work. So let's find something else to do instead. So that it has really spread to the courts, and the courts now are so used to just handing out such lenient, whether it's bail or penalties or plea bargains, that I don't even think they're aware of what they're doing anymore.
Yeah, that's sad. And you know, we've seen this push around the country, Jim, and you're right, it's fairly small, but, you know, you've got people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is, you know, the bright shining star of the Democratic Party at the moment. That's something that she's been advocating for, shutting down privately run prisons and certainly looking at ways to empty out prisons. And, you know, it's fascinating. Look, we've heard the discussion about criminal justice reform for a long time. As a matter of fact, I mean, shortly after Sean Gannon was murdered, like 2 days later, you had the governor of Massachusetts sign a quote-unquote criminal justice reform measure. And I'm all in favor of having these discussions about, you know, should people who are behind bars for a long period of time for nonviolent drug offenses, should they be going to prison for 20 years? I'm happy to have those conversations. But why can't we have that conversation about the other side of the coin, about individuals like the accused killer of Sean Gannon, well-known to law enforcement, 110 prior contacts, and yet not much time behind bars to show for it? When do we get to have that conversation as part of the criminal justice reform effort?
Well, especially in this case, Cam, and you know, we put out a release today about the Weymouth murders, the police officer and the innocent widow. And what was she, 77 years old,
yeah,
sitting in her house or standing in her house, and was killed by this guy? This is precisely the scenario that we fought about during the red flag or the ERPO bill debates. We were talk to everybody that would listen and some that wouldn't, that if you're just focused on people who are so mentally ill that they're a danger to the public, not people who are going through a temporary thing and maybe suicidal, but somebody like this who's a deranged psychopath, that just simply focusing on the gun is a fail from step one. Because in this instance, he didn't even legally own a gun. So you couldn't even use the ERPO law against them if you wanted to. So we're actually just totally ignoring dangerous people, especially people with psychotic tendencies, with severe mental health issues. And again, this was the scenario that we feared. And unfortunately, it came true. Now, the question is, will the state learn a lesson from this, or will they just try to pawn it off on some other excuse? And I'm sad to say, I don't think they're going to learn anything on this one.
I mean, what has typically been the reaction, Jim, from elected officials when people are talking about these light sentences? Are they off? What excuses are they offering up?
Well, it's kind of interesting because they're not offering up much. There's a growing number of legislators that are outraged about it, but the majority really haven't said anything. And I think it's because it goes against the whole stigma or the plan to empty the prisons and empty the jail, and maybe even shut them down, and that, you know, everybody deserves a chance. Everybody deserves a chance, but, you know, maybe one chance, not, like you said, four or five or six. You know, if you have 110 interactions with law enforcement and a list of felony charges as long as your arm, why are you walking the streets? You know, we actually had a big debate years ago. There's a system in mass courts called a dangerousness hearing. And we didn't like what they were doing because they were just focusing on, well, if you had a gun, you could be held for a dangerousness hearing. But if you didn't, then we probably wouldn't go that route. And we were saying that just because you had an illegal gun doesn't mean, you know, you're dangerous or not dangerous. I should say that the other way around. But, you know, I meant it's just because you don't have a gun doesn't mean you're not dangerous. That's what I was trying to say. But and so anyway, they got the system in place. Well, okay, so why aren't you using it? Because you can hold these people and determine if they're dangerous, which obviously they are, but they're refusing to. So there's really a cultural change that needs to happen here. And it's something I've been talking about for almost two decades, Cam, is they always want to talk about the thing, but they never want to deal with the human element, whether it's criminal or mental health. It's never the human element. It's always the thing, because the thing is easy, right? You can pass laws. Oh, we'll talk about the gun. We'll talk about the knife. We'll talk about whatever. But they never want to deal with the person, and that's coming back to haunt us.
Again, talking with a friend, Jim Wallace of the Gun Owners Action League. So, you know, Jim, you talk about how some politicians are actually starting to discuss this publicly. Do you think that that this becomes a legislative issue in Massachusetts before long? Does this become a campaign issue in Massachusetts this year?
Well, I don't know if it's going to be a campaign issue this year, but it certainly could be. And I would say to all these people that were out there marching to restrict our rights a few months ago, they should be out there marching even harder on this one, 10 times harder, because this is real. And it's going to affect their families at some point, because at some point a dangerous person that's released by a court is going to show up on their doorstep, and then, you know, they're going to have nothing to say about it. So I think it's something that we in Massachusetts, our judges are appointed, and as far as I know, they're appointed for life. So you almost have to find a dead body in their fridge in order to get them off the bench. It is extraordinarily difficult to do. And I only know of one instance in Massachusetts since I've been around that has actually happened. So we'll have to see what kind of energy we can generate and go from there.
Mr. Jim Wallace of the Gun Owners Action League, thank you as always, sir, for coming on the program. It's good talking with you.
Yeah, and hey, how about those Red Sox first place, huh?
Unbelievable. It's unbelievable. I know. I've got to have Larry Keene of the National Shooting Sports Foundation on. He's a huge Yankees fan, and for whatever reason, Jim, I promise it's not intentional, but every time we have him on, it's only when the Red Sox are in first place.
Yeah, well, you know, that's good for Larry. So, you know, go down there and have a Fenway Frank at Yankee Stadium, right?
I'm trying to get to a Red Sox-Yankees game at some point this year. So there you go.
All
Jim
right.
Wallace joining us from Massachusetts. Thank you as always, sir. Appreciate it. And Stella Morabito of The Federalist is going to be with us on the program here in just a little bit. What to learn from the social justice warrior who was eaten by his own mob. This a piece that was kind of making the rounds this week on Quillet. I was the mob until the mob came for me, written by Barrett Wilson, which is a pseudonym. He says, I drove I drive food delivery for an online app to make rent and support myself and my young family. This is my new life. He says, I once had a well-paid job in what might be described as the social justice industry, and then I upset the wrong person. And within a short window of time, I was considered too toxic for my employer's taste. I was publicly shamed, mobbed, and reduced to a symbol of male privilege. I was cast out of my career and my professional community. Writing anything under my own byline now would invite a renewal of this mobbing, which is why, with my editor's permission, I'm writing this under a pseudonym. He says, in my previous life, I was a self-righteous social justice crusader. I would use my mid-sized Twitter and Facebook platforms to signal my wokeness on all kinds of topics such as LGBT rights, rape culture, racial injustice. Many of the opinions I held then are still opinions that I hold today. But I realize now that my social media hyperactivity was in reality doing more harm than good. Within the world created by the various apps I used, I got plenty of shares and retweets, but it masked how ineffective I had become outside in the real world. The only causes I was actually contributing to were the causes of mobbing and public shaming. Real change, he writes, doesn't stem from these tactics. They only cause division, alienation, and bitterness. And you know, it's interesting. There was a piece that I saw, ironically enough, on social media this week, and it was advice to Democrats. I think it was advice. And the advice was basically, yes, starting stuff on Twitter and getting into Twitter arguments, that is the way to electoral victory. I could not disagree more, but But that's the advice right now, is to, you know, yes, insult your way, a flame war your way to an electoral victory on Election Day. Barrett, or the guy writing as Barrett Wilson, talks about the mob. He says, one day I was accused of some of the very transgressions I'd called out in others. I was guilty, of course. There's no such thing as due process in this world. And once judgment has been rendered against you, the mob starts combing through your past, looking for similar transgressions that they might have missed at the time. I was now told that I've been creating a toxic environment for years at my workplace, that I've been making the space around me unsafe through microaggressions and macroaggressions alike. Barrett Wilson says social justice is a surveillance culture. It's a snitch culture. This, by the way, is really important. It's an attribute of the social justice crowd that doesn't really get talked a lot about. But it absolutely is true. You know, just as in authoritarian nations like the Soviet Union, where kids were supposed to rat out their parents if they heard their parents say something about Stalin or Khrushchev or Brezhnev, or they said something, you know, boy, I wish we could find something other than, you know, beets after standing in line at the grocery store for 6 hours. You were supposed to report your parents. And I think every authoritarian culture, including the social justice warrior culture, relies and depends on that culture of snitching. Snitches don't get stitches in an authoritarian culture. Snitches get promoted. Snitches get rewarded in an authoritarian culture. Barrett Wilson says the constant vigilance on the part of my colleagues and friends did me in. That's why I'm delivering sushi and pizza. Not that I'm complaining, he says. It's honest work. It's led me to rediscover how to interact with people in the real world. I'm a kinder and more respectful person now that I'm not regularly on social media attacking people for not being kind and respectful. So what lessons are there to learn from Barrett Wilson's run-in with the mob that he was used to running with? We'll talk about it with Stella Morabito, writing at the Federalist after a quick timeout here on Cam and Company. That's right. Excuse me. Thank you, Katie. We do have John Pop waiting right there in the studio because, sorry about that, John, I get so wrapped up in the next segment. I forgot. Yes, we have a brand new Curator's Corner.
Right.
And that we're about to debut right here, and we've got you to set it up.
Yeah, and Cam, no, that was a fascinating story, and I love it when you say snitches don't get stitches. Can you just, I want that on a poster on my wall, please. Cam Edwards.
See if we can get that cross stitch for you.
Great story. So Cam, speaking of great stories, we're wrapping up one more segment after this. Curator's Corner, we're opportunists with Curator's Corner. Wherever I can follow around someone from the museum and we're out there to do a Cam and Company, we grab a few Curator's Corners. So we were at an annual meeting for these, sat down with Jim Sapieca, the director of the NRA Museums, and Phil Schreier, a good friend, the senior curator, and did a bunch of segments out there. And this is a gentleman, Rich Nahas, that Jim co-wrote a book. It's the standard catalog of Smith & Wesson, fourth edition. So Jim knows these guys well. They pull the best and brightest, and this is a really cool thing. There's these oddities, Cam, where they build a firearm, a prototype. I'm going to read this so I get it right. This was the Baby Air Crewman Revolver prototype. It was a five-shot aluminum J-frame Smith & Wesson 38 Special. And it was made so it would be small, survival weapon for an airman if they went down. The problem, it was aluminum. It was a little too lightweight, and the chamber would sometimes blow up. So problem with this, they had to recall them, and they sent out a letter to recall them and destroy them, but some survived. So it is a great oddity and become a great collector's piece. So that's what we're talking about here in this edition of the Curator's Corner. Take a look. And we're back here at the NRA Annual Meeting in Dallas, Texas, 2018. I'm here with a couple of my best buds. Jim Sapieca, Phil Schreier, the Gun Gurus are back here on Curator's Corner. Phil, what's going on here?
Well, John, not only have we got a reunion of the Gun Gurus, but we also have a reunion of the Collective Trust of Smith & Wesson, the authors, co-authors, joint authors, of the standard catalog of Smith & Wesson, Jim Sapieca, and Rick Nahas.
Wow. Could it get any better than this, gentlemen?
Oh, it can, because he brought some cool guns.
Oh, all right. Yeah. Let's
this is the point where I just evaporate.
Yeah.
Phil, you want to leave?
Yeah, why not?
Okay. Rick knows everything Smith & Wesson. But what he knows very best is the lightweight alloy frame Smith & Wesson's, and he has the world's definitive collection of these. He brought it to display, and among the wonderful guns he brought is one of the 10 best in the room, a silver medal winner. If I have this right, Rick, it is a prototype baby air crewman. But let's start out. What is an air crewman revolver?
The term air crewman comes from the word air crewman is engraved on the barrel on the first 605 production guns that were sent to the Air Force.
And this was a design specifically for the Air Force, and it was ultra-lightweight alloys, wasn't it? Frame and cylinder?
That's correct. It was an aluminum alloy frame, an aluminum cylinder, steel barrel, and steel internal parts.
Now, this was quite a breakthrough at the time, wasn't it? I mean, the Air Force was going to a lot of effort to save 8 or 10 ounces of gun.
They were, but you got to go back to about 1947 when they first decided to put bids out for survival weapons. And Smith & Wesson actually started work on this in 1951, and then they came up with the J-frame in aluminum. From there, in 1952, they started shipping guns to the Air Force.
Now, the J-frame's the smallest Smith revolver at the time. It's the little five-shot 38 special, right?
This is a five-shot 38 special. And this one is rather special because it has the short buttstock, a more rounded trigger guard, and it's a five-screw frame. It's rather unheard of. It's the only one that you and I know of that's out there in the world.
So this would kind of have been the prototype for the entire air crewman concept.
Yes, you could say that.
How are they marked? They've got great markings.
Well, the prototype has no Air Force markings other than what Smith & Wesson put it on their standard guns. But the Air Force gun, it has top strap markings of revolver, comma, lightweight, comma. Commas are important. M13.
Well, Rick, these are very rare guns to start with, but they're even more rare because of what happened to them in service.
That's correct. Most of them did not use the correct ammo, and they were designed for M41 ball ammo, which had a pressure of 16,000 PSI. When you went to normal 38 special, the pressure went up to 18,000 PSI. And then if you use really hot stuff, you had a tendency to blow the cylinders apart. So the program of shipping guns to the Air Force started in 1952 and went through 1957. This is one of the last shipments in October of 1957. And in 1958, the M41 ball ammo came out, a little late at the gate there, guys, to be used with these weapons. And in 59, the Army and the Air Force decided we're going to scrap all of them. So they issued a letter of destruction to all units of the military to cut them, crush them, or torch them. So this is one of the survivors.
Wow.
I've kept a log since 1991 of all the air crewmen, where they were in pieces, parts, whatever they were, and complete guns. Who's got them, where they went.
Not a lot of survivors, are there?
I might have 125 complete guns that survived without being pieces, parts, guns.
And
there's
we've
a lot
seen
of those.
Fakes. So popular with collectors, there have been fake guns come out
there
with
are.
Some regularity.
I own four fakes, and I invite you to come to our booth, and I'll show you what makes a fake counterfeit air crewman.
Outstanding.
Right, well, thank you so much for sharing. Gentlemen, thank you for these wonderful Curator's Corners here at NRA Annual Meeting.
Welcome back to Cam and Company. Cam Edwards, your host, at Cam Edwards on Twitter. Top of the hour, we have today's hero of the day. We have our deal of the day. We have our good guy of the day. And join us on the program right now, writing at the Federalist, Stella Morbido, is with us. Stella, how are you this afternoon?
I'm good. good. Good to talk to you.
It's good talking with you as well. I really enjoyed your piece, What to Learn from the Social Justice Warrior Who is Eaten by His Own Mob. I read this piece at Quillet earlier this week. I was the mob until the mob came for me. I was fascinated by this because it's not like this phenomenon is new at this point. That's the thing. I think if you have any sort of self-awareness, you can recognize that, oh, yeah, the mob is very easily going to come for me one day if I do something that they don't like. Maybe we should stand up against these mobs in the first place. But we're really not seeing that. I mean, Stella, we were just talking in the show earlier today about Mark Duplass, a writer and actor and director who had tweeted out something yesterday about, hey, you know, my friends on the left, you should consider following Ben Shapiro. You might not agree with him, mm-hmm. but he seems like a thoughtful guy. And within a matter of hours, Stella, he had to delete the tweet. Then comes the apology from Mark Duplass for expressing his opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But that's the wrong opinion to have, and so therefore you must be punished.
It's really unsettling when you see that kind of stuff. I mean, what's going on? It's just basically a reaction. I mean, what he ended up doing was kind of groveling to the mob, and that doesn't get you anywhere. All that does is whet their appetite for more, and they do turn on you. Just as this piece that was published in Quillet, I Was the Mob Till the Mob Came for Me, illustrates. This dynamic is actually pretty old, but it's hard for people to really learn when they're caught in the throes of this social, or we call, emotional manipulation, mm-hmm. Social psychology, mob psychology.
Yeah, and, you know, one of the things that you highlighted, I thought this was fascinating as well, the description by the writer writing under the pseudonym of Barrett Wilson, that the social justice culture is a snitch culture.
It is
a surveillance culture, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and one for false confessions, mea culpas, if you don't, bend to their will. Yes, it's a surveillance culture, and I use the illustration from last summer. I don't know if any of your audience recall, but the actress Lena Dunham illustrated in her, she has huge Twitter following, and she basically was modeling that snitch culture when she basically stated that she was at JFK Airport and she overheard a conversation between two American Airlines employees that she claims was, quote, transphobic. And so she reported them to American Airlines. And, I think that the part that really annoyed me was, that the airline itself, you get a lot of corporate world is caving to all this stuff as well. So, but what she was doing was modeling and, showing, how to, basically eavesdrop on people's private conversations in order to get them in trouble with, quote, authorities, state-run authorities. So it's very, unsettling.
It is. And as you write, the only way to see this go away is to actually stand up to the mob. And that's going to take a couple of forms. I mean, if you're the object of ire for the mob, obviously not acquiescing, not bending to their will. But when you do that, when you stand up to the mob, when an individual stands up to the mob, Stella, does that then encourage others, those bystanders, to also now come to the defense of the person standing up for themselves?
Absolutely. I mean, that is why it is so important not to remain silent as well as to stand up. We saw this as Kanye West last spring, they were, I don't know what's happened really since then. I don't follow him that much, but he never really backed down from his tweets, and they were trying so hard to get him to back down, when he complimented President Trump. And, it was fascinating. Now, one other rapper, agreed with him, and then that rapper, his name, I don't know how do you pronounce it, Chance, I don't know. Anyway, but he ended up doing a mea culpa after he supported Kanye West. But it's not just that. I mean, we're seeing fissures. We're seeing cracks in this whole social justice industry that's really not what they claim it is. It's not about equality. It's not about justice. It's about power. And and you know, basically, you know, abolishing the Bill of Rights, really, when you get down to it. And so standing up to it is actually, you know, that's a true act of bravery, not, you know, collectively ganging up on someone.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you say, we are perhaps starting to see some cracks. In fact, I thought it was interesting that, and it's, we almost have mobs now going after mobs, which is kind of fascinating, Estella. There was a Twitter moment or a Twitter a thread that went incredibly viral a couple of weeks ago, and it was a woman on an airplane who ended up moving and was like tweeting and taking, you know, pictures of the guy in front of her and the girl in front of her and the sort of love connection that was, you know, sparked right in front of her. And she's sharing all of this live as she's on the plane. And it got, I mean, tens of thousands of retweets. And then,
oh, wow.
And then the people in question actually spoke up. And the woman who was, you know, the sitting in front of the woman who was tweeting said, look, I didn't ask for any of this. I didn't ask for any of this attention. Please leave me alone. People have found out who I am. They found out where I work. This isn't right. This isn't good. And so there was this sort of pushback against, hey, you know what, maybe that's not your place, stranger on the airplane, to start, mm-hmm. you know, tweeting out what these other people in front of you are doing. And it was a public shaming of sort, but it was also that it was the mob going after somebody for doing the type of things that the mob usually really likes to do, to invade people's privacy, to remove that layer of anonymity or just, you know, personal privacy. And it was interesting to see the pushback from people on social media to that.
Wow, no, I missed that. That's interesting. I'm going to follow up on looking at that that piece. I missed that. I am not as active on social media as I used to be, and I was never really active. And I think that, you know, that's all kind of a part of it. You know, as the person in that original piece said, now that he's just delivering food, he gets to actually see people as they are and real life, which is what all the social media, it's a two-dimensional existence, really, and it promotes that, as you said, invasion of privacy, surveillance culture. It's unsettling,
to say the least. Stella Morabito, writer of the Federalist. Thank you so much for coming on the program today. It's a real pleasure talking with you.
Great talking to you. Thank you.
You bet. Hopefully, we'll get a chance to do that again soon. So, Stella is not on social media that much, but you can follow her in frequent tweets at Stella_Morabito. Now, coming up top of the hour, we have today's hero of the day. We have our deal of the day. We have our good guy. Also, Norris Wyden is going to join us from Warrior One in San Bernardino, California, talking about the day in February when a stranger walked into the gun store. Guy Norris had never met before. Something looked a little off about him. And he said, you're that Borat guy, aren't you? And as it turns out, yes, that's exactly who it was. And you won't see Norris Wyden on Sacha Baron Cohen's new Showtime show because he called out Sacha Baron Cohen. And we'll talk with Norris about that coming up here next hour. Also, Kurt Schlichter from Town Hall will join us next hour as well. Do we have that video? Can we go ahead and show that of Norris and the folks at Warrior One when Sacha Baron Cohen in disguise walked into this gun store?
Watch his face. This watch his face. See ya. I'm out of here. This got me caught. Get the out of here, Borat.
You're watching the moment employees of a Riverside gun store say they caught actor Sacha Baron Cohen coming to their shop in disguise and under false pretense.
That is fake.
It all happened right here at Warrior One Guns and Ammo in February 2017, and it was all caught on the store surveillance video.
The moment his words came out of his mouth, I was like, this guy's full of.
That store owner, Norris Sweden, he's the one seen in the video dealing with Cohen and his camera crew after he was told they were there doing a documentary on a Hungarian immigrant wanting to buy a gun.
He comes in off the bat. You can see the video. I'm looking. I'm like, this guy does not look like a Hungarian immigrant. Tight leather pants, a beard. It just didn't fit.
But he says it's what Cohen said after that handshake that really blew his cover.
I want to buy a gun. Like that, talking like that. And I just kept looking at the guy, and I was like, you're Borat. Soon as I said that, his eyes just looked at me like, and he did a B-turn right out the door.
Sweden says the video shows Cohen bailing on his crew after he gets called out. So then he turns to question the producer.
We're talking to the people. They don't want to give us an answer. We basically told them, get the f*** out. You know, you guys are all full of f***. Have a great day. Get out.
There you go. Hey, Katie, tell Norris we're Family Friendly Radio, and you get him on the program next hour, will you? Just let him know. I mean, we can bleep, or you guys just get the bleep button ready. Like it's Morse code that you're going to be tapping out there. But, and, you know, you could kind of tell, right? When he walked in, there's something a little off. But good for Norris for calling him out, and we'll find out a little bit more about that day in February of 2017. I was thinking it was February of this year. This was a year and a half ago. When Sacha Baron Cohen walked into this gun store, the whole setup again, you know, is this Hungarian guy who wants to buy a gun? Yeah, this will be an interesting conversation. Next hour as well, Mr. Kurt Schlichter joining us from Town Hall. And we do have our hero of the day. We have our deal of the day. We have our good guy coming up at the top of hour three, plus more of the day's top Second Amendment news and information. All headed your way. So stick around. 60 more minutes of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady. It's coming up next. Talk with Kevin Dixie from No Other Choice Firearms Training. Kevin, how are you, sir?
I'm fine, Cam. How are you?
I am excellent. So tell me about No Other Choice Firearms Training.
The philosophy behind the training company is this. No Other Choice is just that. So we go out, we want to train people, get them protecting themselves, understanding what the Second Amendment is. However, before you ever use that skill set, no matter what you learn in class, you ever use anything, whether it be a bat, gun, car, against anybody else, you should be at a point of no other choice. You tried to run from the situation, talk your way out of the situation, avoid it altogether, and never be there before you ever think about impacting a human life, even if they so quote-unquote deserve it. Make sure you're at a point of no other choice.
You know, and it's I'm glad that you're emphasizing that, because one of, I think, the misconceptions that we have about concealed carry holders, about gun owners in general, is that we're all a bunch of trigger-happy nuts, right? Who are just looking for an excuse to whip out our gun, when that is the farthest thing from the truth. I mean, if we're ever in a position where you have to defend your life, I don't know about you, Kevin, I never want to be in that position where I have to defend my life.
Right. I've been carrying a gun almost 20 years now, and I've never had to deploy that gun. Now, I've had to deploy it in my form of work before, as far as a defensive tool to do my job, but I've never had to actually discharge a firearm against another human being, because they've always made the smart option of, hey, okay, this is one too far, let's stop. So I disagree with that. I mean, how many people are carrying guns today? And nobody's getting hurt, right? I think concealed carriers are some of the best people walking the face of the earth, because they have godlike power, and they respect it more than anything else. So it's totally false.
So how did you get into gun ownership? How did you get into firearms training?
I was working at the St. Louis City Police Department. I worked in the jail division, and I saw a lot of individuals that were making, good people making bad choices. Well, along with that job came a lot of firearms exposure and training and things like that. So I decided to kind of blend two things. I took the training opportunities, got into guns, started understanding my rights a lot more at the age of 21, and then I also wanted to train people not only to defend themselves against the guys I was working with every day, but also help people that were just making bad decisions to make better decisions, you know, so they're not in situations. So that went to training. Let's teach you how to defend yourself and be safe against some of the evil people in the world, but let's also prevent you from becoming a person that's a good person but making mistakes, and let's blend the two. And that's how it started.
You know, and in St. Louis itself, where you're based, right, and you look at Chicago, you look at St. Louis, you look even in places like New York City or Washington, D.C., Baltimore, you got a lot of violent crime, but you don't have, I think, a cultural or a political push towards responsible gun ownership. It's almost the other direction. They don't want anybody to be gun owners, as opposed to wanting to make sure that training is available for anybody who wants to become a legal gun owner.
Correct. And the reason for that is because guns are polarizing, right? It's a polarizing subject, and a lot of people want to work on the emotion of the community. They want, you know, if you walk outside every day and your situation isn't the best, cosmetically your area isn't the best, it's easy for me to play play on your emotions, right? And tell you that, hey, these guys are bad. Trust me. Let me defend you. And what I'm trying to tell people is, let's get you out. Let's show you what life is. Let's help you out with resources. Once you understand what you're working for, please understand that there is somebody walking this earth that will take that from you in a blink of an eye. So instead of trying to depower you to trust me, I want to empower you for you can protect everything you work hard for. And so whether it's in your current situation or you just want to work hard to get out of your situation, you need to understand you have to have the power to protect yourself. Regardless of what somebody politically is trying to drive you to, understand, take your own responsibility. It's safe. It's fun. It's the ultimate equalizer. And everybody that does it has a level of respect that is ungodly. And you need to understand that and just take it upon yourself.
So 10 seconds or less, Kevin, who is showing up for your training sessions these days?
Everybody. I teach and train everybody, but I have seen a great, great big push in women, and I love it. Women, and I'm getting a lot more anti-gunners in, so it's always fun for me.
How about that? Kevin Dixie. Listen, I appreciate you coming on the program. If folks want more information, where can they get it?
You can look on Facebook at NOC for No Other Choice Firearms Training. You can also look me up, Kevin Dixie, D-I-X-I-E. That's on Facebook. And on Instagram, it's at NOC Firearms Training, all one word.
Kevin Dixie with No Other Choice Firearms Training here on Cam and Company.
You're watching NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour three of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady. It's on the air right now. We have our hero of the day. We have our deal of the day. Good guy as well coming up this segment. Also, Nora Sweden joining us from San Bernardino, California, Warrior One, talking about the day that Sacha Baron Cohen came into the store. Also, Kurt Schlichter from Town Hall will be joining us to close things out later on in the hour. Right now, let's get to today's hero of the day, our deal of the day, and our good guy hero of the day from Dothan, Alabama, and the Dothan Eagle. Dothan police, they say, released a suspect in Monday's fatal shooting after investigators determined that the gunman acted in self-defense. 36-year-old Dennis Jackson surrendered himself to officers hours after shooting 24-year-old Vantavious Deshaun McKay, who later died at a hospital. Dothan Police Lieutenant Lynn Watkins says no arrests have been made in this case. Mr. Jackson has been released with no charges being filed. The case will be presented to a grand jury. Jackson had actually filed a police report as early as the day of the shooting, alleging that somebody was making threats to shoot him at his home. So the day of this shooting, he's telling police, hey, somebody's trying to kill me here. Jackson reported that Vantavious McKay had previously made shooting attempts at his residence. And when McKay returned on Monday, he was shot once in the chest. Happened around 2:40 Monday afternoon near the intersection of 6th Avenue and East Selma Street there in Dothan, Alabama. Witnesses originally indicated to police that the individual acted in self-defense, lived inside a home. At least one person immersed in that residence, initially detained and released. And then again, the individual who was defending himself surrendered to police, talked with police, and police now ruling this a case of self-defense. We'll follow along, give you any updates as they become available there in Dothan, Alabama. Now, today's deal of the day. From Channel 11 down in Atlanta, Georgia. Judge gave accused shooter at exclusive Atlanta community probation for past violence. Christopher Buchanan for Channel 11 in Atlanta reporting says he was an accused teen gang member who pleaded guilty to armed robbery. So why did a judge set free the young man who is already suspected in yet another attack? Jaden Myrick will turn 18 next month. He is back in jail right now, accused of armed robbery again, and this time there is a victim clinging to life. That victim, Christopher Broder, was attending a wedding at a country club Saturday, July the 7th, when he was shot just after midnight following the reception. And records, according to Channel 11 in Atlanta, now reveal that prosecutors warned the judge a year ago not to release Jaden Myrick, but the judge did so anyway. In an August 2017 hearing in Fulton County Superior Court, prosecutors said Myrick, who had earlier pleaded guilty to an armed robbery that he committed in 2015 when he was 14 years old, prosecutors said he was so dangerous that he had committed even more violent crimes during the 2.5 years that he had been in youth detention. And so the prosecutors are saying, look, he can't come out now. He's not ready to be released. He's not been rehabilitated. He needs to go to prison. And the judge said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to put him on probation instead. Fulton County DA Paul Howard said Myrick being granted probation was one of the many bad decisions. He said, quote, court records show he had over 32 misconduct violations while in juvenile detention. They said that his progress had been minimal. Again, this juvenile detention is not supposed to be simply about incarceration. The emphasis in juvenile detention is supposed to be on rehabilitation. The idea being, okay, these are young offenders. They can be reached. They can turn their lives around. Not all of them will, obviously, but that's the attempt anyway. And the records indicate that Mr. Myrick wasn't trying to turn his life around. He was actually continuing down the same road that he had been on. So Myrick's granted probation in August of 2017. The district attorney, Paul Howard, there in Fulton County, says while he was downstairs being transported up to the courtroom for this probation hearing, the Fulton County Sheriff's Department reported that he had forced several young people in detention with him to, quote, eat from a toilet. Yeah. Fulton County Superior Court Judge Doris Downs wanted to give the young man every chance to turn his life around, listen to the assistant district attorney's warning. The ADA said in 2.5 years that Myrick had spent in the Sumter Youth Detention Center in Americus, Georgia for the previous armed robbery. Quote, he was essentially running the blood gang and was committing other violent crimes inside that detention center. Prosecutors believe that he would continue his gang activity if he were released. According to the hearing transcript, the prosecutor told the judge, Myrick committed an armed robbery with a firearm when he was 14. He agreed to a negotiated guilty plea of 7 years in prison, but when he went into custody, he didn't change his behavior. I don't think he's rehabilitated. And the judge said, quote, he's going to get out. That's the reality. He's going to get out now or later. Well, I mean, which is undeniably true. He was sentenced to 7 years. So at the most, he would do 7 years for that crime. But the judge saying, look, he's got to get out one way or the other. I mean, sooner rather than later, might as well be sooner. Judge Doris Downs told Myrick, I want you to get your high school GED. I want you to get a job. I want you to learn life skills on the outside. I want you to turn your life around. Well, he gets out in August of 2017. September of 2017, he's back behind bars for violating his probation. Judge Downs did not send him to prison. So I'm going to give you another opportunity. I want you to live in this community rehab program. Going to send you to a place called Visions Unlimited. So that's where he went. The DA says less than a month after he was granted probation, Myrick showed up on social media involved in gang activity. DA says an Instagram post shows Myrick threatening that if anybody calls police, they'd be shot, including his own mother. Yeah. So by the time November of last year rolls around, Myrick has had his probation revoked for 2 months. Probation, prosecutors asked for probation to be revoked again in May of 2018. That was denied. Still wasn't abided by the terms of his probation. Prosecutors say, hey, can there be some consequences for this? We've been telling you since this young man was released that he shouldn't be released. He hasn't learned his lesson. He's not been rehabilitated, and he has done nothing but continue to cause problems since he's been out. Can we please revoke his probation? The judge said no. That was May. Now it's July, and he's been charged not only with armed robbery, but with critically wounding Christian Broder. Atlanta police say Myrick robbed 4 wedding guests outside of the Capital City Club as they were waiting for an Uber ride. One of those victims, Mr. Broder, who is a father to an infant daughter, shot in the lower abdomen, a random victim, according to police. And the DA there in Fulton County says, like most people, I'm wondering, once you see the evidence, why would you let it go? Why would you let it go? He said, why would you put him in a situation where he could do more harm rather than leaving him in a situation where he would at least have the opportunity to learn and maybe rehabilitate himself? By the way, the DA is also raising some questions about that that community program, Visions Unlimited. DA says that Myrick was not showing up to this program as he was supposed to do, and that Visions Unlimited should have called and reported him to his probation officer. Channel 11 there in Atlanta, reached out to the organization, talked with a founder, Gwen Sands, who said that she could not comment. When asked what happened with the Myra case, the woman said, "I don't have any idea. I don't understand any of it. We do what we do with excellence, with integrity. We stand by our services and our work with our young people." The judge in this case told Channel 11 that she would have no comment about the Myra case. Judges typically don't talk about specific cases, but obviously the DA has quite a bit to say about this. And I'm guessing that a lot of folks in the Atlanta area do as well. So there you go. Today's deal of the day from Fulton County, Georgia, Atlanta, Georgia, and the case of young Jaden Myrick. All right, on to our good guy of the day, brought to you by our friends at Odor Crusher. So I got to say, I had another little Odor Crusher experience here over the weekend. I had my, Katie's laughing at me now. Don't laugh at me, Katie. I'm excited about this. This makes me happy. And it's easy to make me happy, but this makes me happy. I brought my Odor Crusher bag. I showed it off on Friday, brought it down to Bristol with me. Left it in my car for a few days in the sun and in the hot and the dirty clothes. They did get a little stinky. I will be honest with you. A little bit. Just a little bit. I mean, not like full-on stank, but just a little stinky. So before I threw them into the laundry, I decided, you know what, I'm just going to go ahead and give this a go. Plugged in my Odor Crusher overnight bag. Half hour later, the stink was gone. Put my clothes into the laundry. Good as new. So I'm telling you, it works. I want to go on another trip here just so I can pack my bag again and forget to take it out of my car. All right, on to our good guy of the day from KansasCity.com, Kansas City Star. A pretty incredible story, and we've got some video with this as well, courtesy of the Mountain View Police Department and the Kansas City Star. Mountain View Police Department released these videos on Facebook over the weekend. So this is the end of a car chase on U.S. 60 in Missouri. You see the guy get out of the passenger side of the car, and then he takes off running, two officers chasing after him. We're about to switch to the actual body cam from this officer, and you can see a car actually pull off the road and cut this guy off so he can't run, and officers are able to catch up to this guy and then apprehend him. The suspect in this case, a guy named Ronnie Blake, 36 years of age, had a controlled substance and a syringe, which officers believe to contain an opioid substance on his person. They actually later found multiple syringes as well as methamphetamine on this individual. He has been taken into custody, remained in the Howell County Jail as of Wednesday. And the Mountain View Police Department ended up posting this video because they don't know who the driver was of that car, the car that pulled over. Because once the police had this guy in custody, that car just left. Your situation was under control, no reason to stick around. So the police department just sent a statement. The Mountain View Police Department would like to say thank you to a North Carolina driver, because the car had North Carolina plates. They know that. Would like to say thank you to a North Carolina driver in a black vehicle who helped apprehend a wanted felon with no bond warrants who fled on foot during a traffic stop. Again, don't know who that individual was, but we do know that they were in the right place at the right time and willing and able to do the right thing to help a law enforcement make that arrest. And so whoever was driving that black car with the North Carolina plates there in Kansas over the weekend, we thank you, really, for being one of the many, many good guys out there. All right, coming up here in just a couple of minutes, got to talk with Nora Sweden from Warrior One out in San Bernardino, California, about the day that Sacha Baron Cohen came to his store. Meanwhile, a news out of New Jersey. See me Christmas. I mean, you know, again, we've talked with Scott Bach, head of the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs, so often lately about the gun control laws that Governor Murphy's signing, the proposed fee increases that gun owners could soon be facing in New Jersey, where your FID card, your pistol purchase permits, they're going to go through the roof. If you are lucky enough or connected enough to have a New Jersey concealed carry license, you're also going to now be paying $500 for the privilege of being able to carry a firearm for self-defense. This is all an attempt. And by the way, there are more fee increases coming. It's not just for gun owners. It's coming across the board. The Governor Phil Murphy has a lot of plans for New Jersey, and it's going to require a lot of money. So they're going to be taxing everything, including perhaps tap water. Yeah. You know, the water that you pay for that comes right out of the tap. They're going to tax it, at least under a proposal by State Senator Bob Smith, who says it's not actually a tax. Don't call it a tax. Just like don't call it gun control. People don't like taxes, especially in New Jersey, one of the highest tax states in America right now. You really don't like taxes, so don't call it a tax. Call it a, quote, user fee. A user fee. That doesn't really make me feel any better, by the way. Fee still implies I'm going to be paying something, right? More than what I'm paying right now. He said, quote, it is a user fee based on volume. And he says it would add 10 cents for every 1,000 gallons of water a home uses. He says, look, it's only going to add $32 a year to the average water bill. Big deal. Big deal. He says, we already have a franchise tax on water system operators for a penny per 1,000 gallons of water delivered to a consumer. Councilman Peter Brown, another Democrat there in the legislature, says, let's call it for what it is. It's another tax. And Matt Rooney, who runs the conservative website SaveJersey.com, said, the most overtaxed people out of all 50 states in this country are being asked to dig a little deeper after Phil Murphy just raised their taxes by nearly $2 billion. Dollars. Well, you know, again, big plans, got to pay for it somehow. And whether you like those plans or not, if you're a New Jersey resident, yeah, you're going to be ponying up. All right, stick around. We got to take a quick timeout. When we return, Nora Sweden out in San Bernardino, California, joining us. Stick around. Much more Cam and Company on the way right after this.
And I'm proud to be.
When I wrote God Bless USA in 1983 in the back of my bus, it was full of my heart. It was full of what I meant to say about where I came from. If tomorrow the things were gone, I'd work for all my life. I wanted to say I'm proud to be an American because I felt very proud of my country. And it had been a long time since I heard anybody say that. We're a melting pot of people who find it difficult to say something about all of us together collectively. And that's why I wanted to say, I'm proud to be an American, whatever an American is. You know, it's from Japanese to Irish to English to German, you name it. We are Americans together. And lastly, I won't forget the men who died for our freedom. We do travel the world with God Bless the USA with the military. And I've done 30 USO tours. So no matter what country we're in, I'm usually under the safeguard of the United States military. And I've only come under fire a couple of times. But if every citizen in America knew that that's the kind of danger our troops are in, they'd have a little bit more respect for the danger, particularly this war on terror, which is more jungle warfare and desert warfare where you don't know where the enemy is and who they are.
And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that life to me.
Well, everybody knows Bristol's a very different track than any other NASCAR track. Everybody has a beer cooler and they're dragging it into the stadium and they know they're going to be there for a long time after the race. A lot of camaraderie, a lot of pre-race stuff, a lot of after-race stuff is kind of fun. And in the setting of East Tennessee, there in Bristol, where it's surrounded by such beautiful stuff, thank God for sports events in this country. To see a night race there is a little special because I think you have to be engaged as a fan. At night, you kind of get the whole magic of it all, even if you're not a fan. The amount of people who believe that America is the greatest country on earth and are proud to display it at that track, oh my gosh, you just have to go to Bristol and see it. I mean, you know, there are bigger tracks, there are bigger arenas, but Bristol's the place to come and see the display of Americanism. Fantastic.
More people dream of moving to America than any other country in the world. It's true. 150 million people would drop everything to come here, if they could, because they desperately want what so many of our leaders seek to destroy. The freedom to speak your mind, worship your God, build a business, leave a legacy. and defend your life and your loved ones. These are the basic building blocks of the American dream, an idea that still captivates human hearts like nothing else. In this time of such uncertainty and doubt, we must hold fast to the principles of freedom. For it is with these timeless ideas, not the elites who scorn them, where the hope of mankind still rests. We're the National Rifle Association of America, champions of civil rights and freedom's safest place.
I'm a law-abiding citizen who's never shot anybody, never committed a serious crime, never committed a felony. But it seems like every time we have one of these shootings, nobody wants to put the blame where it goes, which is at the shooter's feet. You want to put it at my feet.
I felt like I needed to say something for all the people out there that I just spoke about, the people who have come together, who are together, who feel unified, that majority of people who obey the law, you know, and work hard every day, and are just tired of people trying to pull them apart and pull them in all different directions. I think there's millions of me across the country, and I'm hoping that each one of those people will go out and tell these politicians we're not going to take it, and we're going to stand up for our rights, and we're going to hold on to them. Anyone who is concerned with holding on to the Second Amendment, I absolutely think they should join the NRA.
Bristol Motor Speedway, the place where you can forget about work for a while. Celebrate the good old USA and take in the best bumper banging, fist waving, hero making short track race of the year, the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race. It's America's night race. This is what you live for. So be there August 18th. It ain't just another race. It's Bristol, baby.
Welcome back. It is Cam and Company right here on a beautiful Thursday afternoon coming to you from downtown Farmville, Virginia, where I don't think Sacha Baron Cohen even knows where Farmville is, for better or for worse. But I want to welcome to the program right now out in San Bernardino, California. Norris Whedon is with us from Warrior One. Norris, how are you, sir?
Hey, what's going on?
Well, listen, you tell me. This is a fascinating story. You know, when Sacha Baron Cohen's new show popped up on Showtime over the weekend, and several segment of supporters were the subject matter of at least one of these segments there. We actually talked about this earlier on the program. Our producer, Cameron Gray, got he was attempted. He was an attempted punking, just like you were. They sent him a letter asking him to go on camera and talk about Israel. And he, too, he said, you know, something's off here. But he didn't actually talk to anybody in person. You did in February of 2017 when Sacha Baron Cohen walks into your store. We watched this surveillance video a little bit earlier, Norris, and set this up for us if we can, because we see this character walk into your store, but there's already a film crew there. So how did this all come about there in your shop?
So the way it came about is we had just got done probably 2 weeks ago shooting a pilot for our own show called Down the Barrel for a major network. And what had happened is that we get a call from a production company that says, hey, we'd like to come in and shoot a documentary of a Hungarian immigrant that wants to buy a gun. Hey, listen, we're all about that. You want to buy a gun, you know, a Hungarian immigrant citizen, come on in. That's America for you. So we tell them, come on in. Production company comes on in first. And obviously you see me in the video standing there waiting for him to come in. So this moron, when he comes on in, looks stupid, okay? You got to understand, in the gun business, you pay attention to people. You talk to people. Yeah. You get to know them, because I'm selling a firearm, and I take this stuff serious. It's that simple. This guy looks like
absolutely
an idiot. You know, tight leather pants, stupid hat, stupid-looking vest. So immediately you can tell he's acting. I mean, you could spot it from a distance. He's acting. You could tell. I'm trying to make eye contact with this guy, and he's not he's not making eye contact. He keeps trying to talk to the producer. He's not saying much. He's muttering, you know. You see, I just look away. I'm thinking, okay, this is a joke. So that's when I really call it out. I had some nasty words. He does a beeline right out the door. He disappears quick. He gets whisked away. And then, you know, I basically told those producers there who were very vague, wouldn't give me the right information to get out.
So they never did cop to it. They never did tell you, yeah, all right, you got us. That was Sacha Baron Cohen.
No, because I said that's Borat. That's exactly what I told them, and they were trying to deny it. And that's what I told them. I was like, dude, get out, okay? I'm not going to deal with your guys' shenanigans right now. You know, just go. Yeah. But I actually, you know, said it a lot more harsh because, listen, I'm all about the Second Amendment. You know, we are in the gun business, but I'm also about to – You don't. It's freedom of speech. You don't want to buy a gun, don't buy a gun. You know, I've been saying that all day. I'm on both sides, okay? I'm here to protect you. We've been in business for over 10 years to protect you. You want to buy pepper spray, buy pepper spray. But if you think you're going to come into my shop, my business, my blood, sweat, and tears, my customers, and mock it, it's not going to happen. It's just not.
Yeah, and I don't know what the line of questioning would have been or where Cohen would have tried to take this, but obviously the intention would have been to make you look bad, to make the shop look bad, to make you look as, you know, a crazy or nutty as possible. This wasn't, you know, that's one of the things that I got to say I don't like about Sacha Baron Cohen's shtick, is because it's not about. Actually, all right, well, I'm somebody who agrees with a gun control. Let me go talk to a gun owner and find out, you know, what they think about this. Maybe we can find some sort of common ground. It's now let me try to make the people that I disagree with look as stupid as I possibly can, even if I have to deceive them in order to do so. You know, as you say, I mean, you've operated this business.
Right.
Go ahead, Norris. I'm sorry.
No. You're right, Cam. You're exactly right. Listen, stick to your stupid comedy. Don't come into the gun world if you don't know the knowledge. But if you really want to know it, ask me. If I don't know the answer, guess what? I'll figure it out for you. You know, the reason why he duped those politicians, because, like I've been saying, they're not in touch with the people. They get their votes, they go sit their fat butts on the seat, and nobody's talking to the people. You know, find out what's going on. You know, these laws in California, they're strict for a reason, and gun owners get upset. Let me tell you why they get upset. Because they don't make any sense. Okay, no criminals come into the store and say, hey, guess what, Norris? I'm going to commit a crime in 10 days, so I'd like to buy a gun. It doesn't work like that, you know? And if these politicians would sit down in the state capitol and say, hey, Norris, you're a gun owner. You've been in business for 10 years. You got an excellent record. You're a former cop. Listen, what can we do to make backgrounds better? What can we implement in a system to change things? So when you have people that get upset about the Second Amendment, why they think we're always complaining about the Second Amendment, we're actually not. What we're trying to say is, listen, can we find a common ground? We get what you guys are saying. Let's just find a common ground because the laws you're implementing don't help.
You know, and that's the thing. I mean, so, you know, operating a gun store in California for 10 years, obviously you've seen no shortage of gun control laws passed either via referendum in the voters in the state of California or lawmakers in Sacramento. And I would say both of those groups, broadly speaking, Norris, don't have much idea about how firearms actually work, how gun laws are enforced. They hear something, well, that sounds great. You know, what if we did require everybody to show ID and get an ammo card every time they purchase ammunition? You know, if you're not a gun owner, that sounds great. What if we end all mail order ammo sales? That's fantastic. And they don't necessarily, again, they don't think about what actually goes into this. How has your life changed as a business owner, as an FFL in California over the past decade?
You know, it's difficult. You have to find new avenues and new things to keep business going. I can tell you right now, the reason why we only have one store is California is just making it too difficult. There is a time where we're going to open 5 stores, and it seems like they consistently tighten the noose on the guns, which, like I said from the beginning, you know, politicians, listen, the reason why you guys got duped is because you're not paying attention. you're just getting in your butts in the seats and you're not listening to business owners. You're not paying attention to what's going on. You know, having an ammo law ain't gonna do, is not gonna do anything. Having ammo not shipped to your house is not gonna do nothing. Banning where you're only gonna have 10 round magazines is not gonna do anything because I'll just buy more mags. You see what I'm saying? There's a simplicity to this that they don't pay attention to. And for a long time, I kept my mouth shut. Well, guess what? Now you just opened Pandora's box because I'm tired of keeping my mouth shut. I'm tired of you guys doing this. And it's not – I'm upset and I'm passionate about it because I don't care what that moron Borat did. I really don't care. You want to mock politicians, you want to do that, that's fine. Where I'm upset is Showtime thinks they can put a bunny on a gun and have a so-called gun advocate. What are you doing on TV, you moron? Stay off. You're not a gun advocate. You're an idiot. What are you doing? Putting a dinosaur on a gun? Come on. So what is Showtime really doing? What are you doing? You know, you complained about these school shootings, which is a travesty. You know, I it breaks my heart. You know what I mean? But yet Showtime goes and says, oh, we want to put kindergartens with guns. Well, you know what then, Showtime? It's a double-edged sword. You know, why don't you put a real show on TV about real Americans, real citizens buying real guns, and for what reasons? You know, that's what our pilot's about. You know, it's called Down the Barrel, and it's about real people buying real guns. You know, why don't you put that instead of this moron, stick to comedy, Borat. You know what I mean? What you did, if they would have not put any stuffed animals on the guns, and they would have made those politicians look like morons, that's fine, whatever. I really don't care. But now everybody's complaining and everybody's trying to voice their opinion, which is fine. Go ahead. But, hey, guys, if you're going to slap the Second Amendment, pay attention to freedom of speech where Showtime is putting stuffed animals on guns.
Talking What's that about, North Sweden from there you go. Talking again with Norris Sweden from Warrior One in San Bernardino, California. We're almost out of time here, Norris, but let me ask you, you know, you said that a couple of weeks before Borat had come in, you guys had shot your pilot. Have you found a home for your show yet?
So our show actually has, it had a home, unfortunately, and it breaks my heart that all those shootings happened, and once those shootings happened, it got put on hold. But I can tell you right now, Cam, you know, I could care less if I have a show. That doesn't bother me. If it happens, great. If it doesn't, you know, I'm still going to voice my opinion. It's that simple.
Well, listen, we applaud you doing that, sir. And I know that, you know, living in California, San Bernardino is the quote unquote good part of California as far as the Second Amendment goes. It might take you a while to get your concealed carry license because the demand is so high in San Bernardino County. But at least it is seen as your right of self-defense. Norris, I mean, before we run out of time here, I got to ask you because we're looking at, you got legislation right now that would ban gun shows at the Cow Palace. You've got that court decision that says it's okay for Alameda County to pass a zoning ordinance that bans the construction of any new gun stores. You've got politicians who are proclaiming that we need to go after quote-unquote gun culture in California. And they don't mean gang members. They don't mean people who are using guns illegally. They mean the law-abiding Californians who are coming to your store, who are going and they're getting trained. They're getting lessons in how to safely and responsibly handle firearms. That's the culture that these anti-gun politicians are targeting. Do you foresee a day where it's just going to be untenable for you to remain in California, or are you going to stay and fight as long as you can?
Hey, so, Cam, we're in Riverside, so I'm going to tell you one thing. I'm going to fight to the day I can't do no more business. It's that simple. But here's the thing. The reason why all this happens, brother, and I'll make it perfectly simple. The reason why all this happens, like I said from when this first started. Hey, politicians, call me. I'll help you figure this out. I'll help you do the gun bills that will work. I'll tell you what works and what doesn't work. And like I said, they're not paying attention. If you're going to restrict certain things in the gun business, talk to the gun owners. Say, hey, gentlemen, what works? Where's a common ground that, you know, we're not going to push you guys out of business? And I don't know. Maybe it's California's goal to do it. Guess what? You guys got something coming because America was founded on guns and our forefathers were founded on guns. and people love guns. They love to shoot them. They love it's a sport and it's protection. But nothing's going to change until they meet with people like me or other gun, not that other moron holding a bunny, but to get in the real world to figure out what's going to work and what's not going to work. That's really it,
absolutely,
Kim. It's got to come down to that.
Yep. You got that right, Norris. Listen, man, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. It's good talking with you today.
Cool. Absolutely, man. Same here.
Thanks so much, man. You bet. Norris right, Sweden, we'll join us from Warrior One out in California, the Riverside gun store owner confronting Sacha Baron Cohen. Kurt Schlichter of Town Hall is going to join us here in just a couple of minutes, talking about his latest column, as well as some of the other stories breaking over the course of the week. And we will get to Kurt here momentarily. Before we do, one quick note. In beautiful Cleveland, Ohio, the League of Women Voters held a forum yesterday. Ohio gun laws, what are our options? The League of Women Voters, by the way, is billed as a nonpartisan organization, right? Just all about turning out voters on Election Day. They are also really, really anti-gun. Really, really anti-gun. The participants in this forum, sponsored by the League of Women Voters of Greater Cleveland, the Moms Demand Action Group, Ohioans for Gun Safety, and the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence. You will note I did not say Buckeye Firearms Association, did not say Ohioans for Concealed Carry, because apparently they weren't invited to take part in this forum on Ohio gun laws. What are our options? Because apparently the option of strengthening and securing the right to keep and bear arms, that's not seen as a good option by the League of Women Voters of Greater Cleveland. Dave Eggert of Ohioans for Gun Safety says his group's sole mission is to establish what he calls, quote, common sense background checks for gun buyers. He wants to collect enough signatures to have a referendum placed on the ballot in 2019. Now, I haven't seen this proposal by Mr. Eggert, but I would assume that the quote-unquote common sense background checks for gun buyers that he is referring to are the quote-unquote universal background checks that every town for gun safety, Moms Demand Action, and other anti-gun groups have been pushing around the country. But here's the thing. There's nothing really common sense about them. There's not. Garen Winnemute, researcher at UC Davis out in California, an anti-gun researcher, just looked not long ago at background check laws, the quote-unquote universal background check laws that went into effect a few years ago in Washington State, in Colorado, and in Delaware. And all he was looking at, by the way, was whether or not background checks increased after the laws went out of the books. And they didn't, at least not in Washington State, and they didn't in Colorado. They did increase in Delaware. And Garen Winnemute, you couldn't really account for why that would be the case, why they would go up in one state but not in the other states. And he didn't look at the crime rate in all of those states, but I have. And during that same time period that Garen Winnemute was trying to figure out, okay, are more background checks being conducted? In Colorado and Washington State, crime went up a little bit because crime went up a little bit nationwide during that same time period. But Delaware, the state that actually saw the increase in background checks, they also saw the biggest increase in their homicide rate of those three states. So from a practical standpoint, there really is no evidence that instituting these quote-unquote universal background check laws actually lead to more background checks, much less violent crime. No real indication of that at all. In fact, there's not really any indication that these laws are really used or even enforceable. In Washington State, I'm aware of one case, and one case only, that after the fact, after a crime had been committed, an individual was arrested and charged with a misdemeanor of transferring that firearm without going through a background check. One case. That's it. Millions of dollars spent to get this law in the books. And in Washington State, they only have one case to show for it. In Colorado, I'm not aware of any. In Delaware, I'm not aware of any. So what exactly makes this a common sense proposal other than a gun control advocate calling it a common sense proposal? What's actually commonsensical about it? We'll keep our eyes on this ballot initiative that gun control activists are working on in Ohio. But when we return, our friend Kurt Schlichter joins us, senior columnist at Town Hall. We'll be back with more Cam and Company coming up right after this.
And I think your story is really important for a lot of Americans right now, because you went from somebody, you were just living your life, you weren't really into politics, and then all of a sudden, the government took an interest in you and said, whoa, Martha, you want to have a birthday party your farm?
That's right. That's exactly right.
We're going to need a permit for this. Hey, Martha, your water hose, your garden hose is out, and you need to move that back in, or else, you know, you could lose your farm. Tell us a little bit, if you can, about, you know, the local government stepping in on your small farm there and trying to tell you what you could do on your property.
Oh, absolutely. And it was the local government working hand in hand with NGOs, in particular a radicalized environmental group.
Piedmont Environmental Council.
And they wanted our farm, and they were willing to do anything to get it. And it really started this tsunami, if you will, in Virginia of, you know, support statewide, crossing party lines, people coming out to support me and to change the law in Virginia to prevent what was happening to me from happening to any other farm in Virginia. And basically the law changed. I'm so honored and humbled that it carries my name, that says that if you're farming in Virginia, the government can come in and require, you know, miles long and deep and wide, you know, regulations, permitting requirements, fees, and so forth, for you to be able to live the American dream. And, you know, it has really inspired me to continue to fight, not just for farming issues and agricultural issues, but really to fight and protect our liberties all across the board in America. I'm now with America First Policies, and we are the only sanctioned, if you will, outside group for the White House, so we advance the vision for America for the Trump-Pence administration.
You know, I have to think the legislation that you helped pass trickled up. Now, just full disclosure, last time I saw Martha, I was Skyping with a friend, and Martha popped into the screen in a leopard print dress.
I did.
A very surreal moment. So.
Wow.
That's a true story.
This happened. This is very true.
A couple of months back.
Yes, this is true.
Secretary Zinke, Interior Secretary Zinke, on the panel this morning, talked about exactly this, and then President Trump talked about it, how Obama literally made it illegal to have a puddle on your property. All of a sudden, it became a lake.
That's correct.
And you were going to be basically villainized by the government. So I have to believe that lawsuits like yours helped drive that federal deregulation we're now seeing that made. And the president specifically referred to farmers today and how these people couldn't work.
Yeah.
Their livelihood was literally taken away by crushing regulation.
Absolutely. I mean, the EPA, you know, you were not, thankfully, having to deal with the EPA. It was bad enough that you were dealing with, you know, the local government.
Right.
But you've got farmers who are trying to plow their fields.
Right.
And the fields that they've plowed for years and years, now all of a sudden, you know, some government employee comes out and says, whoa, that's a wetland.
That's exactly
right. You can't plow that.
And probably one who's never been on a farm. The bureaucrat.
The farmer will explain, well, look, it gets wet when it rains, right? It gets when it rains,
but
it's not a wetland.
Right, and the EPA was so drunk with power. Basically what they were saying through the waters of the U.S. WOTUS laws was that if you have a navigable pond of water, a navigable could literally be a puddle.
Right.
And if it's navigable, well, you know, guess what? A little puddle can be navigable. And said that they would put huge restrictions, basically taking your property rights away from you if you have navigable water. And thank goodness that this administration decided to do away with those horrendous overreaching regulations and laws that were really strangling American farmers all across our nation. And, you know, there's still more work to be done. But every time I see overreach, it really makes me, you know, reminds me of what my family went through, and it makes me want to stand up and fight not just for our family, but for everybody's liberty.
You know, we've got to take a break in just a minute, but I want to ask you, because, you know, right now, again, it's the 2 minutes hate against the NRA and its members right now. Did you get that locally? Because I know in the part of Virginia where Martha lives, the Piedmont Environmental Council is seen as a good guy organization, right?
Yes.
They've got their little stickers, shop fresh, shop local, eat fresh, eat local.
Yes.
And so, you know, like, it's the good thing to do.
Yes.
And so I'm wondering, I mean, were you vilified when you started standing up and speaking up for yourself?
Yes, 100%. And, you know, it's a little shocking at first because, you know, it's hard to understand. Wait a minute, I'm fighting for the American dream here. I'm fighting for something as American as apple pie. What farmers built our nation, and it's really hard to understand why, you know, you're personally attacked. You're vilified, and especially, what do they say? All politics is local.
Right.
And so, you know, but understanding that, overcoming that, is a huge victory, not just, you know, for me, but for everyone. And for everybody listening, you know, my advice is stand strong, never give up, and keep fighting the good fight for the American dream. And in the end, we will win, and we are winning. And to just, you know, keep the battle alive.
Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV, your first source for Second Amendment news and information. Cam Edwards, your host. Before the end of the program, we'll give you a sneak peek at what is coming up on tomorrow's Cam and Company. But right now, I want to welcome to the program senior columnist at Town Hall, author of the upcoming book, which is absolutely fantastic, Militant Normals. Mr. Kurt Schlichter is with us on the program. Kurt, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Thanks for talking up the book, of which you blurbed, may I add.
I blurbed it twice. I liked it so much.
Multi-blurbing. I like it.
It's the like book's having, so nice,
it's why there's
it
no
twice.
Unemployment. Everybody's got two blurbs.
Exactly. That's how it works. You know, it's something like that anyway. Yeah, boy. Let's start there, actually, if we can. It was so amazing, Kurt, when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez won the Democratic primary in Deep Blue, New York. Now, granted, she knocked off, a member of Democratic leadership. She knocked off the number 4 Democrat in the House, Joe Crowley, in a, I think, 21% turnout to primary. But she was elevated immediately to the next big thing in Democratic politics. And then people started actually doing interviews with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Kurt, and it became readily apparent that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez really doesn't know what she's talking about a lot of times.
Yeah, it went downhill fast. She's not super in tune with stuff, for sure. You know, I don't want to be unkind, but she's eminently unqualified for any position that involves, well, maybe Congress, because you know who's in Congress, so, well, maybe she's in the right place.
There's a low bar for Congress, but again, if you're going to be seen as the leading intellectual light, right, if you're going to be seen as, okay, this is the person who's putting forth these policies that are going to allow Democrats to capture the youth vote and propel them forward into victory, and again, you're saying things like, well, the reason why the unemployment rate's so low is because people are working two jobs. Talking about the occupation of Palestine, and then I don't really know what I meant by that. I'm not a geopolitical expert. You are running for Congress, and you did win your primary, and you're almost guaranteed to win the general election based on your district and the voters there in your district. So, yes, I don't think it's unfair to actually ask Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez about these things. I mean, you know, Kurt, she was even asked about democratic socialism. And asked to define democratic socialism, and she's having trouble with that. She calls herself a democratic socialist, but she can't really define it. I mean, if I were to call you a militant normal and say, Kurt, how would you define that? You could probably give me an answer, right?
I'd give you my book. No, but yeah, you're right. I mean, look, I don't get this whole thing about democratic socialism. If you put democratic in front of something as a modifier, does that somehow always make it better? Is it like, hey, look, I have a democratic skin condition. You know, it doesn't help. And it doesn't help when socialists know less about socialism than it's socialism's opponents. Look, here's the basis of my opposition to socialism. First of all, I married a wife whose family got arrested in a socialist country, and then she and her family, you know, left. I served in the ruins of socialism, and I'm not talking figuratively. I'm talking literally in the ruins, in the Balkans. So, I mean, you know, me and my family, we have personal experience with what happens when you go socialist. And then I hear, you know, this 28-year-old, silly woman babbling about it. And, you know, it's always, oh, well, if we have socialism, we'll be Norway. Well, you know, why do you think you wouldn't be Venezuela?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really, why would we rely on you to, like, dodge that bullet? America's not exactly a monolithic ethno state in a small confined area like Norway is. I mean, why would you expect
it's largely
it to...
dependent on...
Well, we saw what happened with the oil with Venezuela, didn't we?
We did. But here's the thing. See, Norway is a little smarter than Venezuela. Norway is at least socking money aside. Venezuela is taking the oil revenue and immediately spending it, and then the price of oil. But here's the thing.
Of course,
you're right.
Norway's
why don't they ever bring
socialist.
Up Venezuela? Just like with gun control, they always bring up Great Britain. They always bring up Australia. Sometimes they'll bring up Japan, but they never bring up Mexico.
Yeah.
Why
Brazil.
Is that? Mexico has really great gun control laws. There's one gun store in all of Mexico and a homicide rate that is far higher than the United States. Why not bring up Brazil, where less than 2% of the population legally own guns and the homicide rate dwarfs that of the United States? You're right. They always pick the things that they think that they can, you know, turn the United States into, and then they just say, trust us. Right?
Yeah, trust us.
Just trust us that we won't fail.
Trust us that the best case scenario is going to work out. And it's not, you know, it's so annoying. It's so annoying because it's so dumb. You would think that after 100 million corpses got piled up in the last century, that people would look at that weird 19th century cult called Marxism and say, wait a minute. No thanks. Yet every generation breeds a new crop of idiots with their Che t-shirts and idiotic ideas. And we've just got to keep battering it down.
Absolutely. But, you know, I don't know if you had a chance to read this because I know it's probably not on your normal reading list. But The New Yorker actually came out with a very long puff piece on Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Came out this week. But it's worth reading because there is this attempt within this article to redefine socialism down. And so it's not there. I mean, there's actually a line in there about socialists these days don't talk much about Marx. And instead, they talk about Franklin Roosevelt and Teddy Roosevelt. They talk about, you know, bringing out a new deal, a new deal and a new fair deal. And that's what it's really about. It's not about Marxism. It's not about any of that stuff. And yet,
you know,
if you actually talk to anybody who describes themselves as a democratic socialist, they'll tell you, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez will tell you, capitalism is on its way out, right? We're in the middle of late stage capitalism. I mean, look, that's Marxism, Kurt. That's not, as one democratic socialist said, democratic socialism is Eisenhower republicanism. Well, talking about late stage capitalism and what comes afterwards is not Eisenhower republicanism.
No, it really isn't. And it's interesting that, you know, when you're on the left side of the fence, you're always lying about what you want. We conservatives are, and I'll tell you right away what I want. You know, I want every American to have constitutional carry. I want voter ID. I want half the departments of the federal government shut down and their employees fired. I want a whole bunch of things. I'll tell you all of them. I'm not going to hide any of them. But you get to the leftists, suddenly they're not liberals, they're progressives. Suddenly they're socialist, but not really socialist. But they really are. And you just, they can never tell you the truth. And because what they're selling is snake oil.
Talking again with Mr. Kurt Schlichter from Town Hall. New book, Militant Normal, is coming out this fall. Hey, speaking of selling, did you see that the Brady Bunch house is up for sale, Kurt, in Studio City, California?
I did not. That's like the ultimate 70s house.
I'm just throwing it out there. I mean, I know you'd probably rather spend the money on Beamers, but just saying, if you ever wanted to live out the Mike Brady life, man, now's your chance.
You know, with housing values out here, it's probably $4 million.
1.9.
Really? That's actually a bargain. I'm actually stunned.
I believe it's a three-bedroom, two-bath. Yeah, 1.9, and the original owners lived there until they passed away, and their kids are now selling the house. The original owners paid 61,000. Well, I guess they weren't the original owners. They bought it after the show was over in like 73. Paid $61,000 for their home, for the Brady Bunch house in 1973.
That's amazing. My parents recently sold the house they bought in San Mateo, California, halfway between San Francisco and Silicon Valley, that they bought in 1972. They just sold it. So I know what's happening. It's insane.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. So there you go. So, you know, I'm just saying, if you got any more Ben Shapiro cases, now you could squirrel that away and you could buy the Mike Brady house.
Well, that's, you know, that would be cool.
I think that'd be a perfect headquarters for the Schlichter Worldwide Empire. I really do.
the Schlichter Worldwide Empire. I should have like a giant octopus as my my symbol. No, wait, wrong Kurt. Wrong Kurt. Sorry, everybody.
Oh, I just got that. It took me a second. Oh, there you go, the Schlichter Puss. Yeah, there you go. Always good to get a Kurt Eichenwald reference in. Hey, listen, man, we are unfortunately almost out of time. Give folks a plug for the book one more time. Where can they buy Militant Normals?
Militant Normals is now up, including Cam's blurb, at Amazon.com. You can get it hardcover. You can get electronic. Go get it now. Pre-order it. So when October 2nd comes out, you will have it delivered to you right away. And, you know, I hear also that first week I may be in Washington. I may be sitting in with you, according to your crack staff.
Excellent. I look forward to seeing you when the book comes out, if we don't get a chance to see you in person before then. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your week, sir. Good talking with you today.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. Kurt Schlichter joining us, senior columnist at Town Hall. All right, so coming up on tomorrow's program, we've got Andrew Langer from the Institute for Liberty talking about this crazy decision in Baltimore where, you know, again, it's the murder capital of the United States right now. And what's the city council doing? They're passing local ordinances barring sodas from kids' menus in Baltimore restaurants. Also, Dave Koppel of the Independence Institute. Tony Katz will join us on the program. And, you know, talking about socialism and the inability of or unwillingness of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to actually define what it means to be a democratic socialist. So NPR actually has a piece that they ran, I think, today or yesterday, getting to know the Democratic Socialists of America. And it's interesting. One of the people that they spoke to is a Democratic Socialist, and this was in West Virginia. And Joe Cernelli is his name. And he said, quote, "I think we just need to realize that the end goal is ultimately like social control of the means of production, you know? We just don't want to improve capitalism. We will ultimately want to get rid of it." NPR says that's not just his idea. The DSA, Democratic Socialists of America, views capitalism as an oppressive system. In the DSA's ideal economy, some sectors like healthcare and utilities would be government controlled. Other businesses, NPR says, would be worker owned, still government controlled, but worker owned as well. And, you know, those folks, those on the ground, Democratic Socialists of America, have no problem whatsoever saying that, yeah, we're anti-capitalism, we want to see it end, and we'll build on the ashes, which is kind of Marxist. The Democratic Socialists running for Congress don't seem to be quite so honest about their intentions. All right, have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow.